Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, December 16, 2019. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to National Liberty Alliance and click on the weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of a website of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, our scripture reading is going to be in the Gospel of Mark. We're going to pick up where we left off last week. Gospel of Mark, chapter 8, verses 11 through 21. And the Pharisees came forth and began to question with him, Jesus, seeking of him a sign from heaven, tempting him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and saith, Why doeth this generation seeketh after a sign? Truly I say unto you, there shall no sign be given unto this generation. And he left them, and entering into a ship, again departed to the other side. Now the disciples had forgotten to take bread, neither had they in the ship with them more than one loaf. And he charged them, saying, Take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, and of the leaven of Herod. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, It is because we have no bread. And when Jesus knew it, he saith unto them, Why reason ye because ye have no bread? Perceive ye not yet, neither understand? Have ye your hearts yet hardened? Having eyes, see ye not? And having ears, hear ye not? And do ye not remember, when I break the 5 loaves among the 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments took ye up? They say unto him, 12. And when the 7 among 4,000, how many baskets full of fragments took ye up? And they said unto him, 7. And he saith unto them, How is it that ye do not understand? That was the Gospel of Mark, chapter 8, verses 11 through 21. Okay, tonight we're going to take a look at a paper we wrote to be filed today. It's dated the 13th. You can get a copy of this up at our website and follow along if you'd like. It's at go to nationallibertyalliance.org. Highlight grand jury and click on action against the judiciary. And it's up towards the top. After a couple of paragraphs, you'll see that there were papers filed, a declaration of restoration ordered on 8-17-19, and there's a list of papers that we filed. It's the one that's dated December 13, 2019, Acts of Treason, should be plural, Acts of Treason by the Federal, Acts of Treason, Federal Rule 2. Now, the United States Supreme Court and both houses of Congress are guilty of treason at least 8 different points. We're going to make those 8 different points. And I'm not sure that it's 8. It could be 7. It could be 9. But it's about 8. But there are 8 things that they have done. And there's more than that. But these are the real focal points. One of them deals with Rule 2. And so each week between now and the next 8 weeks, we're going to be serving these papers on the United States Supreme Court, the federal judiciary, and both houses of Congress through the judiciary committees. And we will, of course, be sending a copy to President Trump and the Attorney General Barr. And there's a few others we send copies to. This one here will probably, Jan's going to muster some people together. Anybody who wants to volunteer can get a hold of Jan, but we may already have enough volunteers at this point. We do want to serve this paper on all 94 federal district courts to the chief judges. It's a 4-pager, so the cost is going to be an envelope, printing 4 pages, and putting 1 stamp on it. That's the cost. We don't need to certify going to these federal district courts, particularly focusing in towards the chief judge. Anyway, Jan, let me know tomorrow how's that's going. I'm trying to think whether we might want to file this paper. Matter of fact, I think we should file it with the governors. If we can get it to the governors, too, that'd be good. So I'd like to do the federal district court judges and the governors. We will serve, and I will be serving the United States Supreme Court and both houses of Congress, and et cetera. So anyway, this will be the first of, like I said, about eight papers.
You want the Court of Appeals too, John?
Yes, the Court of Appeals too. Yes. Okay, so I'm going to read this paper. If you want to read along, again, nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight grand jury. Come down a wee bit. It's the first one right below that. So action against the judiciary. Click on that. And you'll click on the one that says Act of Treason, Federal Rule 2, filed December 13th, 2019. This is a short paper. Like I said, it's only 4 pages, so it's going to go rather quick. And we'll move along into hopefully discussing this a little later. Or whatever people want to discuss, but here we go. This is a case originally filed in December 2016, and since then we've written many mandamuses, and we've now come to the conclusion of the matter. August 14th, we filed decisions and orders against the United States Supreme Court and both houses of Congress. And this paper is, again, a writ mandamus ordering them to obey the law and laying out some of the violations. This is the first of about 8 or 10 papers that we'll be filing over the course of the next 8 or 10 weeks. And this is on the abrogation of the law of the land, treason. Abrogation of the law of the land, an act of treason. Comes now, we the people, under the judicial oversight of the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury, in this extraordinary action to restore the law of the land, being both the tribunal of this extraordinary action and the authors of all law under the authority of natural law by right of the covenants of 1776, 1789, and 1791 with our Creator under his natural law at large, to reiterate and clarify that we the people have found a preponderance of evidence that many members of the United States Supreme Court, the federal judiciary, the United States Congress, and the United States Senate are systematically and covertly subverting the law of the land, violating the following subsections under United States Code Title 18, Section 115, Subsection 2381, Treason, 2382, Misprision of Treason, 2383, Insurrection, 2384, Seditious Conspiracy, 2385, Advocating the Overthrow of Our Government. The defendants have levied war against the Constitution and thereby we the people. They have given aid and comfort to the enemy within the United States and elsewhere. They have concealed a conspiracy to destroy our republic. They have engaged in actions to subvert the government of the United States. They have conspired to conceal natural law, also known as the law of the land. They have, in congruence with the teachings of the American Bar Association, the National Lawyers Guild, the American Civil Liberties Union, the National Lawyers Association, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and many other anti-constitutional associations, knowingly and willfully advocate, abet, advise, and teach that natural law, and thereby the law of the land, has been abrogated, and thus have conspired to overthrow our republic. Any judge who does not comply with his oath to the Constitution of the United States wars against that Constitution and engages in acts in violation of the supreme law of the land. The judge is engaged in acts of treason. Defendants concealed our natural law courts under Federal Rule 2 in violation of 18 U.S.C. subsection 1001. According to the Federal Judicial Center, a government agency, on September 16, 1938, pursuant to its fictional authority under the repugnant Rules Enabling Act of 1934, stated, the Supreme Court enacted uniform rules of procedure for the federal courts. Under the new rules, suits of equity and suits of common law were grouped together under the term civil action, claiming that rigid application of common law rules brought about injustice. This was an act of treason, whereas the United States Supreme Court and the U.S. Congress, under the teaching and guidance of the treacherous, subversive American Bar Association and the aforesaid anti-constitutional associations, in an act of treason, executed a silent coup by claiming the abrogation of common law, also known as natural law, with its unalienable rights that were endowed by our Creator, and covertly substituted them with civil rights legislated by lawless men. In Miranda v. Arizona, we read, where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. In conclusion, we realize that many federal and U.S. Supreme Court judges and U.S. representatives are caught between a rock and a hard place. But when the deep state is eradicated, we will judge your allegiance to the law and the people. Ordered that the United States Supreme Court, the federal judiciary, the United States House of Representatives, and the United States Senate honor your oath. Article 6, Clause 3. The senators and representatives before mentioned, and members of the several state legislatures, and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support the Constitution, and thereby obey the law of the land. Article 6, Clause 2. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuant thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made, under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. Resolved. We the people hereby nullify all construction of law that claims common law, also known as natural law, and their respective courts of record abrogated. Any clerk or judge that continues in the repugnant practice of concealing natural law courts and charges a statutory fee for justice is guilty of treason. Resistance and all anti-constitutional acts will be met with indictments. Filed December 13, 2019, Albany, New York, Grand Jury Foreman, Natural Law Tribunal. Okay, that was quite a short paper, and we're going to keep the next series of papers, again, laying out their acts of treason. We're going to be keeping them very short, to the point, focused, and we're going to give them orders. By the way, we did move the gun case. Let me get to the page. Hang on a second. If you go up to the same page where you were to get the copy of this paper, highlight grand jury, come down action against the judiciary, and back on November 16th, 2019, we filed an amendment to moved for cause. It was in the federal court, but we moved it into our court of record for cause. They did default as of today, which is December 16th. Let me see, which is exactly 30 days. We're going to have to give them a couple of days anyway, so we're not going to do anything till next week. Probably the 23rd we'll file a paper. We're going to file a default on that, and we'll see where that goes, and we're going to file it, of course, with a decision. To cease and desist. And we are going to go after all the judges that are charging for access into the courts. We're going to particularly focus in on the federal district courts, though. We're not going to go through the states at this point. That will happen. First, we have to win in the federal courts. Once we win in the federal courts, we can move everything into the federal court for cause and win that case as far as the Constitution is concerned for our liberty to be respected and acknowledged by our servants in our government. But anyway, acts of treason, Federal Rule 2, and there'll be at least 6, 7, or maybe 8 or more papers to follow, very short and focused. Okay, let's go and maybe we could discuss some of these things if anybody has any questions when we go to the open forum in a short while. Jan, do we have any questions or do we have any announcements to be made?
Yes, we have a couple questions here.
You want to do the announcements first? Do we have any announcements?
We have the same announcements that we had last week, and that is that you gave a talk on Patriot Soapbox here a week ago Sunday, and oh my goodness, there we go. And well, I guess the IRS meeting has passed. We still need a couple researchers to track down these election laws. There's some that are quite resilient to attack, and we could still use a couple people to help out there. And we still have had, I think, only one or two volunteers for the 10 positions open for the committee man process, where we have 10 groups spread out over the 50 states. We need leaders for each one of those. And also, I don't know if most people know, but we're working on what we call an NLA wiki, which is kind of a WikiLeaks lookup. So people will be able to go to that web page and type in questions and come up with answers from our Monday night calls and other sources. And that's a rather huge, extensive, ongoing project, and we could use some workers there to help out as well. And that's about the extent of the announcements that I have.
All right, and anybody that's not in the course, remember what Jefferson said, if the people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. It's not going to happen. Of course, he didn't say it that way, but in any event, I think everybody gets the message. You can't have any authority, any power, any kind of a position against the government if you don't know the law. And the law is quite simple. It's not a complicated thing like their law. This is not man's law. This is God's law. This is natural law. These are, self-evident truths. The Constitution is literally a series of self-evident truths. It's obvious that government is to operate the way it is to operate, in the way we laid it out in our Constitution. The Bill of Rights, a list of some of our unalienable rights, and it's just the beginning of them. And the Declaration of Independence, very clear, points to self-evident truths and brings us under the law of God. And people need to understand these things. They need to know the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. They need to know the authorities. They need to understand the powers and the authorities that they have. Okay? So anybody who's not taken the course needs to get into that course, Government by Consent course. We also have a civics course. Some people take them both at the same time. We suggest, of course, if you want to do one at a time, Government by Consent course is the most important. We're up to Chapter 6. On a Government by Consent course. It's going to be about 14 chapters. We're stuck on Chapter 7. I've been trying to get back to that and a little bit here or there, and hopefully I'm going to get a couple of good solid days into it and we'll get that chapter done. Chapter 8 through about 13 or 14, I forget how many chapters we got, is already done, but I can't post them until we get Chapter 7 done. Chapter 7 is a very large chapter, and it covers all three of our founding documents, Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. And also we'll also be looking at the amendments 11 through, I think, what is it, 27, I think. So we'll be covering all of that in Chapter 7. It'll be broken up in A, B, and C or something like that. But again, that's the only thing holding us up. As soon as I can get that done and up, the rest of that course is going to fly. Anybody waiting around, and maybe you're bored, I hope you're bored, I hope you need to do something, you can do one of two things. Matter of fact, you can do both things. You can volunteer and help us in some of the things that Jan's been announcing. And also, you could take our civics course. Civics course is a very, very interesting course. We cover, lay it out exactly how America got to where it is. We lay this out in documentaries. We also cover a good overlay of the Constitution. Michael Bodnarik, we have his videos up there, and that's part of the course. We have Bill Thornton's recordings up there. Some of them are part of the course. A lot of videos. Most of it is videos and audios, and we ask a few questions here or there as you move along. But everybody needs to be taking these two courses. This is Jefferson spoke about a proper education. I have not been able to find a proper education. There's lots of courses out there, and they talk about this or they talk about that. They may give a little bit of information on the Constitution here or there, but generally speaking, it's nothing but pablum. They never really get down to the nuts and bolts. They deal with, like hearsay information, or they refer to the Constitution on this or that, but they never get down to the nuts and bolts of the Constitution. Brent has been teaching us a lot of the Constitution and the Declaration over the past months, and we're going to get into a deep detail also in a written form and from a different perspective, they'll both be consistent. I'm sure you'll find that to be true. But the way we're going to approach this is going to be quite different than the way we've approached, that anybody has approached this, maybe, I think you might say. But again, I'm looking forward to getting this thing done. I certainly hope that, you know, we're coming up to the holiday weeks here, 2 weeks of holidays coming up, or a week, shall I say. And hopefully during that time period, I can get it completed and get it up there. I only need a couple of days to finish some of my research and in certain areas and get it done. But once that's done, you know, you'll have the whole thing. And you know, hopefully, maybe in January, I'm going to move the book that I've written to try to get that published and see how that goes. One way or the other, we will get that published. I got a couple of ideas that I think we might be able to get, you know, a couple of places I might be able to get it published. But if not, there are places we can go that we can surely do it. Anyway, we'll see how that all goes. Meanwhile, okay, do we have any questions now, Jan?
Yes, first one. I'm told by prosecutor response letter that our case in New York State has been ordered closed. What is he talking about?
Yeah, we have notified the clerk there that, you know, that if they were to tell people on the phone that this case is closed, it's as serious and as them destroying our papers because they are concealing our case. We have indicted the judge that closed us down, I think, 3 times, actually. The second time he did it, you know, we kept filing papers and he had to come out a second time and then we indicted him, and then recently he came out a third time and we indicted him a second time on other charges. We're still filing papers, it's still going in, we're getting resistance, but we're nailing the papers to the doors of the United States Supreme Court. We're calling them out on treason, them and both houses of Congress. And when the swamp is finally drained and charges are made and arrests are being made, their protection is going to be gone. And then we're going to see what they're going to do then. Those who step up to protect our Constitution and the people and their rights, in other words, honoring their oaths, that's fine. But those who don't, we're going to indict. We're going to indict United States Supreme Court judges. If that's what it's going to take, that's what we're going to do. And we will indict people in Congress also. Again, we're going to see who's going to step up and be obedient to the law. As a matter of fact, we should get together a committee. Let's think about this as a matter of fact. Jan, anybody who wants to get into this committee, get a hold of Jan. I'd like to go through Congress and through the Senate and make a list of people who have been doing the right thing and a list of people which are truly the enemies you know, we'll have to discuss how we're going to approach this, but we need some points made up, you know, a few lines of information concerning the individuals who are not keeping their oaths. And yeah, pretty much all.
One of those lists is going to be awful small, John.
I know. But, you know, they're all guilty, ultimately, because they're guilty by ignorance to begin with. You know, we the people can't be ignorant, and we can't allow the people who represent us be ignorant. We need to take over the committeeman process, to take over the judicial process, so that we can make sure that only people who know the Constitution, who have taken a course in the Constitution, in other words, a proper education. You can get that proper education right here at National Liberty Alliance. We have researched our the things we put together on our courses. You will find them most enlightening, and you will find them exciting and empowering. You know, if you're not finding those things and you're bored, then we've written the wrong things. You know, the things that we write are very powerful and exciting. So people need to know these things. We need people to step up. We need more people to become administrators. We need more people to become committeemen. Now, to become a committeeman, you know, you can go to our website and you can click on the highlight committee man on the blue bar, come down and click on become a committee man and sign up there. We will be teaching people the process over the course of the next months. I don't know if Jeff is here. Jeff, I've been trying to get a hold of you during a couple of times this week. I haven't been able to get you. If you're here on the call tonight or if you're listening tomorrow on this call, give me a call so we can work out some details on dealing with the information we need on the election laws for each state. Okay, anyway, people need to step up. We need committeemen. We need lots of committeemen, you know, and every administrator should become a committeeman. You know, again, there's no conflict of interest. You're one of the people, and it's only about 40 hours a year. That's it, 40 hours a year, you know, if that many hours. And you, what you'd be doing is interviewing people that want to get on the ballot. The committeemen are the people who decide who gets on the ballot. Don't we want to take those positions? That's the position of power. That's the position of authority. That's where we consent to government. We tell people, you don't know the Constitution. We've asked you questions. Go away and learn it. Come back. Come back next week if you want, or next year, whenever you want. But go out to National Liberty Alliance, take a proper education on consent of government, and when you finish with that, you come back, we'll ask you some questions, and if you know the answers, then we'll put you in, but then we're going to hold your feet to the fire that you are going to obey the law and maintain your oath and keep your oath, otherwise we will take you out as quick as we put you in. That's the attitude we the people have to have, and that's what we the people must do. And if we don't do it, then we're giving up our liberties, we're giving up our nation, we're giving up on our posterity. We're giving up on everything. Why bother with America if we're not going to defend it? If a people expect to be ignorant and free, they expect what never was and never will be, period. So, people need to step up and do this. Everybody should become a committeeman. For those who, for some reason, can't come a committeeman this time around, well, then next time around. Everybody must become a committeeman once in their life. But I want to tell you right now, we need a minimum of 15,000 people across this nation. That's about 5 people per county, okay? In fact, I think that's exactly what, well, it's just pretty much that. We've got a little over 3,000 counties, 5 people per county, that's 15,000 people. It's about 15,000 people we need. 15,000 people to take back the entire political process, to make the decision on every person that goes on that ballot, to make sure that they know the Constitution, they understand their oaths, and they understand their powers, authorities, and jurisdictions. And if they don't know that, they can't come into office. And then we will hold their feet to the fire. If they break their oath, we can recall them. The committeemen can recall them. If they break the law, taking some of that funny money that's called a bribe, we the people will indict them and we'll remove them through indictment. That's how we have consent of government. People need to step up to take control of this process. We don't have enough people stepping up to do that. You know, we only have a little over 1,000 people that decided to become administrators. We need 15,000 people there. And that's a paid position. That's a position that would be a very rewarding position to be. It's a full-time job. It's a career. And all these people, all the people, and now is the time of educating, by the way, because over the course of the next months, when the things start to fall apart, we the people need to step up and take control and understand how to do it and by what authority we do it. We need to be empowered. Knowledge is power. We become empowered by knowledge. If the sheriffs had power by knowledge, we wouldn't have any problems. Our problems would be gone, but they don't. And next week we're going to be talking a little bit about the militia. We have a meeting. We had a meeting over the weekend with some militia people, and we're going to be working together. We're going to give them a place here in National Liberty Alliance. We'll get into more of the detail over the next weeks as we develop them. We're putting a plan together, and I think every living soul that hears these recordings and hears these Monday night meetings or is a member of National Liberty Alliance, everybody should join the militia. Every able-bodied human being. should join the militia. Let me repeat that. Everybody should join the militia. And we're going to connect with our sheriffs through the militia. We're putting together a plan now. So when this happens, get ready to jump in there, sign up, get together. And, you know, look, we're not doing anything strange or anything. We're really just organizing within our counties, and we're bringing this into a national level. So we're going to organize in all 3,133 or 34 counties. And we're going to educate. The militia is going to, once you get a half a dozen people or more within your county, and we work together to understand how to approach the sheriff and what information to bring with the sheriff, then we're going, each county will group, and within each county will visit their sheriff, and they will communicate to them what we're doing, invite them to the meetings, and ask the sheriff to come to the first meeting to understand what we're doing and to help assist us to keep within the law so he understands it, you know, give him a little power there. And we'll train him on the Constitution meanwhile. We'll give him courses. We'll give his deputies courses. They should be taking our courses. And we'll get to know who we are. But, you know, we tell the sheriff, if you can't make it every one of our meetings, just send one of your deputies. You should be represented here. We want to stay within the will of the law, and we want to learn the law, and we want you to learn it better. You know, we'll give them, let them think we think that they know the law, which they don't. They know nothing about the law. The one thing they do know is the Second Amendment. I am very surprised on the sheriff standing up on the Second Amendment. We've had over 90% of our sheriffs in New York State step up for the Second Amendment and tell that governor up there, up north, who should do, well, whatever, tell him where he can go. He can take a hike. And we heard about that sheriff in Virginia who went to a meeting and threatened, they're trying to create the gun laws there in Virginia. I think it was Virginia. I'll be corrected if I'm wrong. Someone can correct me. But that sheriff stepped up and said, not my county. And he says, I'm going out and I'm going to start bringing people and deputizing thousands of people, because we're not going to stand for it. And we, matter of fact, we got a copy of that story. We put it up on our website. I'm trying to think where I put it. But it is up on our website. And we have the follow-up story just days later that the legislators backed off and decided not to write the legislation after all. One sheriff, that's all it took. But we all knew that all the sheriffs, or 90% of the sheriffs within that state, definitely, just like here in New York, would have stepped up with him, because that's the one thing they do understand. Go figure that. The rest they don't understand. We need to educate them. Okay, so anyway, really, everybody should join the militia, unless you are disabled in some way and you can't. But you know what? Even if you're disabled, you can join. You could do something. Participate. Even moral support within the system. You know, every veteran for sure should be there. Every veteran should be in that group. And again, even if you're disabled, you know, just for the moral support to be there, to step up and say, you can't take my liberty. I'm going to protect it. And let's train the sheriffs. Let's teach the sheriffs. Let's educate them. Let's empower them. And in the power, in the process, empower yourself. Okay, forget where we were. We were in the middle of a question, weren't we, Jan?
Right. About the New York State case.
Okay.
In order closed.
Oh, yeah. So, look, they're going to, we don't care what they do. We're going to continue to send the papers. We're going to continue to indict. As a matter of fact, I wanted to do this last week, and I didn't do it, but we're going to do it this week. We're going to call up the Northern District, and we're going to ask them about this case, and we're going to see what they say. And then we're going to find out who we're talking to. And we're going to ask them if they wanted to recant that and reconsider the way they're dealing with this, because right now we're planning to bring you up for indictment and any other clerk that answers the phone the same way. So that's what we're going to do this week, I think, and we will do an indictment if necessary, and we'll continue to indict and to indict and to indict. These are common law indictments. We're operating completely 100% within the law, and they know it. And that's why they fear us, because we do have power, we do have authority, and they're afraid to make a move right now, and that's good. And believe me, in another couple of months, they're going to be looking for a rock to hide under, because the president and the Justice Department is coming out after them. The deep state is going down. Okay. What do we got? Anything else, John?
Yes. Next question. While waiting for this joinder to run its course, what can we do now since my kids and I are still being pursued? For instance, we're under a fraudulent CPS case. There's a 12-month hearing in February. We are subjected to CPS by common monthly home visits. That reminds my kids and me of the unjust acts against us and potential dangers.
Right. I've been there, you know, myself many years ago, and one of my children, very, very young, was injured, and they tried to go after us. We were visiting someplace, but anyway, I appreciate, the concern. We're doing the best we can on our end, and I know everybody else will be doing the best they can on their end. Sometimes we file a paper, and they obey it. Rare as it may be, it happens occasionally. Most of our papers are usually ignored because they've taken a stand. They've taken a position. As soon as they call up the federal judge, you know, destroys the whole process maybe. Or they call up to the Northern District and they destroy it. But the papers are going through. The papers are being filed. Everything is lawful. And when we return back to the law, there is no way they can ignore what we have done, and they will have to face and pay the toll, face the piper or whatever that saying might be. They're going to have to pay the toll the toll of justice. And then at that point, justice will be given and people will be able to get justice at that point in time. But some people will get it before, because sometimes a judge will get a little frightened and back off and let the case go. I think we just recently had one. I'm pretty sure we did just have one. Jan, are you familiar with that?
No, it was something. I wasn't involved in that.
Well, maybe Jim knows about it if he wants to pipe in on that. But I think we just recently had one where the court backed off. Again, it doesn't happen that often. But you are protecting yourself by getting your papers in, because at some point it's going to be upheld. There's no getting away from that. You know, we're going to be sending a paper to President Trump soon. Did someone? Okay. We're going to send a paper to President Trump soon. It's going to be an information. And that paper, we're going to focus in on law, and we're going to focus in on our rights, our unalienable rights. We the people don't want some of our rights. We want all of our rights. We the people don't want half a right. We want the full right. We the people want law. We don't want some of the law. We want the law, period. We don't want to hear nothing. We want the law of the land. We want it to be obeyed, and we want it to be honored. We want people to keep their oaths. And so we're going to send a letter, particularly a paper and information to Donald Trump, and we're going to cover some of the difficult things. You know, people who don't have knowledge of liberty don't really understand what liberty is. And there are certain things that they don't understand, and they fear. They fear the liberty. Okay, they fear that liberty for you to be the decider and king of your life. Not to be controlled by any municipality, whether it be the local town, village, or city, or state, or county, or whatever. No. You get to control it. They don't have the power and the authority to write anything to control our behavior, except for what we gave them. Commercial business, we gave them an authority. And there are other authorities we've given them, but never have we given them the authority or the ability to write any kind of legislation to control our behavior. That's my job. That's between me and my maker. And if I violate another individual, if I injure another individual, then I have to deal with that. I'm going to be held liable for that. In common law is so simple. So simple. There's one main rule that covers it all. It's very simple. Do no harm. Three words. That's it. Do no harm. Do no harm to anybody, and do what you please. Do anything you please. Do no harm. All right. Anyway, so we're going to write a paper to him, and we're going to cover some of the difficult things that he may find difficult, or people in general will find difficult, because they may be ignorant to it. I do not think that President Trump is ignorant to these things, and I think the paper really may not even be necessary. But maybe it is. We don't really know. So if there's areas that he's blind in and he needs to be educated in, then we will educate him in those areas. Like the fact that you cannot write a statute to control my behavior. That's the key point. You know, no legislation that interferes with my liberty. My liberty is my liberty and my business. Do no harm. All right. What else? Did we have a question there? I got lost again, I guess. Huh?
Yeah, I think it's answered adequately.
Okay.
The next question is, the judge also ordered me to keep my kids in brick-and-mortar school. I previously homeschooled last year due to school battle for special education, punishments for inabilities, and so forth. But CPS placed my kids back in public school. I can't find a school attorney.
Okay, listen. This is very interesting. There is a group of lawyers. Okay, they do a fantastic job. They may play in the statutory process, but they do a great job protecting homeschoolers. I'm trying to remember who this group is. If you went and Googled things, you know, keywords on this thing, homeschool legal advice, homeschool legal something or law, you'll find them. I just can't think of the name. I'll try to dig that up. Maybe if the question comes in next week again, maybe I'll have the answer of who this group is. I homeschooled my children. We did get a little bit of a problem in the beginning. We filed our papers. We joined the it was like $100 a year or $200 a year. And if you have a problem, you get an army of lawyers to come down to protect you. They're there to protect the rights of the people to send their children to homeschool, and that's all they do. And they do a fantastic job. And they have protected so many people. Everyone that I knew years back that were sending their children the same, you know, taking their children out of the schools and homeschooling them, they joined this legal group for a couple $100. I think it was $100 a year. Maybe it's two. And you have, you make a phone call to them. They'll make phone calls. And if they can't fix it on phone calls, they'll send letters and then they'll come out and they will protect you. Matter of fact, they may be even help you get rid of this problem with the social services interfering in the family courts and all that other stuff. So that's where you want to go. I'll see if I can get that info. And if anybody knows it, maybe they can pipe that info in the name of that group of lawyers. Okay, what else you got?
Okay, I will be looking into vaccinations, warnings, labels that you'd mentioned on a previous call. I have some contacts that may help me, such as the ladies in my Ohio Medical Freedoms Group. So there's not really a question there, more a statement.
Can you read that again?
I will be looking into the vaccinations, warning labels, and
okay.
So on.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit about that over the past weeks, and we did, we made a contact with a couple of individuals. We got some of the research done by Robert Kennedy Jr., and he's an excellent researcher. He's very big in the vaccine situation, anti-vaccine all the way. He's connected certain diseases with these vaccines, and he's not the only one. There is a video out there, Dr. John Bergman. As a matter of fact, we have a little bit of his information up on our website. And if you go out to YouTube and put in Dr. John Bergman, B-E-R-G-M-A-N, and you will get a slew of videos from this guy. He's been researching disease and all kinds of things for years. And he's showed, he'll blow you away, the information he gives you. There's pretty much, there's cures for almost every disease out there, if not all of them, okay? And most diseases are self-caused. You know, what he has discovered, and did a video on this, he has discovered the source, I think the name of the video particularly is the source of, source of disease, I think it is. Okay, if you go through his videos, you'll see it, the source of something, the source of disease. And what he discovered, you know, he looked back and people have never been as sick as we are today, you know, never. We've never had the problems that we have today. Cancer is on the rampant. Why is cancer on the rampant? People having all kinds of different problems that going back, you know, 50, 60, 80, 100 years ago, sure, people had some of these diseases, but, you know, it was nowhere near what it is today. So something's going wrong in our environment. And he's made it clear it's two things, okay? One of it is diet, that, you know, fructose corn syrup is a major player in this role player in this thing. The biggest problem is pharmaceuticals. Everybody's on pharmaceuticals. Kids are on pharmaceuticals. Kids get together and they have all these pills and they throw it in. They throw their pills together and then they take each other's pills. I guess they get high off it or something. I don't know. But all the kids going to school, two out of four kids are on pills. Well, one out of every two are on pills, taking some kind of a pill. You know, to control their behavior, in particular. You know, they want to drug our kids. It's like sending them into an institution, drug them up so they don't cause any problems. That's what they're doing, okay? And so this is causing problems. And, you know, we don't even know what one pill does to you. Go look up any pill and you know, sudden death, you know, blindness. I mean, all kinds of things. I mean, serious, serious things could be caused by these things. And over a period of time, these things affect you. But not only do we not know what one of them do, what does two of them do, or three of them do, or four? And a lot of people are on two, three, four, five, and more medications, and they have no idea what is happening when you put two of these medications together and put it into your system. They have no control, no idea on that whatsoever. And that's all they do, all they do. You know, I don't have high blood pressure, but every once in a while, you know, I go to the doctors, they see the pressure maybe a little high, usually because I'm walking up the stairs or to the place or whatever, and, you know, I don't have high blood pressure. I check my blood pressure all the time because they told me I did have it. I don't have it. But they want to put me on pills. Last doctor I saw on that, he's telling me, well, you know, just because you got a high blood pressure right now, you need to take the pill anyway. It doesn't matter if you get low pressure here or there. I mean, this is insanity, okay? So people are sick because of this. Our children are sick because of this. We have problems. So anyway, Dr. John Bergman, source of disease particularly is one thing that you want to look at because he lays this position out with the pills and with the diet and different stuff. But he covers an array of illnesses and gives you the alternatives, the natural way to go deal with these things. A lot of our problems would disappear just by stopping, you know, some things in our diet. You know, I work, you know, really diligently when I go to the store trying to get things without that high fructose corn syrup, trying to cut that completely out of my diet. It's hard, you know, but because it seems to be everywhere. But you can find things out there that don't have it in there. Don't take them shots. Don't take them flu shots. They're deadly. Don't take any pharmaceuticals, you know. They're deadly. Okay. Next.
Last question. Was communism outlawed in the 1950s?
No. Communism is not necessarily outlawed. You know, you have freedom of speech. You can speak and do and say whatever you want, okay? You can't incite a riot or anything like that. Look at debate will always, communism will always succumb to debate. But here's the key thing. If one of these people that are holding up a communist point of view wants to run for office, they need to know the Constitution, and they need to honor their oath. You don't come to run for office to use that as a platform to take away our guns, because that's treason. And matter of fact, all these people that are trying to make these laws to take away our guns, they're committing treason. They're violating the people's right to bear arms, our unalienable right to bear arms.
I beg to differ with communism. Communism is against the Constitution of the United States.
Absolutely is.
It is outlawed. It is not allowed. It cannot run because their whole thing is to take over and subvert. and to take God out and take the Bill of Rights out. So how could you run on a platform that says we're going to destroy your Constitution?
No. I'm not saying that. You can't. That's my point.
How
you
can
cannot.
A Communist Party run?
No. You're missing the. They didn't ask about a Communist
they
Party.
Said it was communism outlawed.
It's not. Look at
the law in the United States, because what it does is it works to subvert the U.S. Constitution. So
well, if you're subverting the U.S. Constitution, that's exactly my point.
That's what it means to be communist. Like
No. Well, hold it. If a person wants to talk about communism and believes in communism, they're free to express their beliefs.
Yes, but you can't run.
That's the point I'm making. If that person that has been spewing forth communism and believes in communism and decides they want to run for an office, then when they run for that office and they raise their hand to take that oath, they cannot bring those communist positions into play as a platform, because they'd be using that platform of that elected office as a platform in order to destroy our republic, and that would be treason. But as an individual in the street, walking down, talking, doing whatever they want, say, I believe in communism, I think the communism is the best way, they can say and do whatever they please, but they cannot take that position and run for office. That's the point. So
they were going after people in the entertainment industry that were communists, remember?
Well, they could be communists as long as they, again, you can't run for an office and hold a communist position. And it's not outlawed, and I'll tell you why. We have a Congress full of Democrats that are socialists. We have socialists running on, all of these Democrats seem to be running on a socialist, platform. That shouldn't be. If the people were in charge, we wouldn't allow that. But right now they're doing it, so clearly they're not executing the law.
Muslim politicians that believe that it's convert or die. They believe in jihad.
They can believe what they want, but they cannot bring it forward off of their platform.
How could they believe in we're going to take you over and you convert or die? That's the whole thing.
Well, of course that would be a crime. That's why they would have to be removed from office.
That's what their book is.
I understand that, but you're missing the point here. What I'm saying is an individual can say and believe what they want, and nobody can do anything about it as long as they don't injure anybody. They can say they're a communist. They can believe in having three wives. They can believe in anything they want. They can express anything they want. That's freedom of speech. But you can't take that into a political position, to be elected in a political position, and then bring that platform into that. In other words, let's take an atheist. If you're an atheist, you can be an atheist. That's none of our business on what you want to believe. But when you come into office, okay, we believe we have unalienable rights given to us by a creator. You don't have to believe that, but you have to protect that. You took an oath to protect and defend that position of that thought, that belief from the people. And that's what you have to do. And when you break that oath, then you're in bad behavior and you need to be removed. You take the two senators here in New York State. They're the ones that have pushed this gun law stuff up everywhere. They're the ones pushing it out everywhere. They're constantly talking and preaching. We got to take the guns. We got to make more laws. Look at those people should not be able to do that. They should be removed from office by the committeemen. But there are no committeemen because the people don't want to get up to become committeemen. They should be removed from office by the grand jury because we can indict them. But there are no grand juries because they're controlled by the lawyers. So we need to take those powers back and enforce the law of the land. They cannot violate the oath that they took to defend and support that Constitution, which includes, of course, our unalienable rights. It's the law of the land, common law. So, yes, you're right. But you know what? Whether there's a law or not, they're not applying it. I'm not aware of a law. There should be. But do you know where that law is, Gerard?
They're putting in Sharia law and Noahide law that says that if you say a certain thing...
That has no power or authority over us.
Your head taken off.
Yeah, but that has no power.
Well, you go into a community that has Sharia law, it'll have power over you because they'll take your head off.
Well, they're going to get away with that as long as the people sit on their hands and don't become committeemen and don't respond to the grand jury and become administrators and take control of our nation. They're going to continue to be places like that. You're going to go to California where they have these all these things going on with people who have come illegally and they're protecting them. That's all unlawful, okay? We know it's unlawful. We can't do nothing about it now, but we can plan to do something as soon as we take it back. It's up to the people to do it. But people can believe whatever they want, but when they take an oath to support and defend the Constitution, no matter what you believe, you got to support that belief over your own. And if they can't do it, then we got to yank them out of office. We can either indict them or remove them through the committeemen by recall if we take the systems back. But only the people can save America. Only the people. Donald J. Trump cannot save America. People need to get that through their thick skulls. President Donald Trump cannot save America. He can bring us back to where we belong. But if the people don't step up and take control and take consent of their government on the political and judicial side of things, we're only going to return back to where we came from, back to the Maya. We'll be back again. Rest assured, we will be back again. Anyway, what are the questions out there? Jan, anything else?
No, that was all of them, John. You're done.
Okay. All right. All right, I'm going to pass things over to you, Gerard, and we'll take Brent up before we do that. Are you ready to take things?
Yeah, is Brent here?
Okay. Yeah, Brent's here. Is Brent unmuted?
I saw him earlier. I don't see him right now.
Well, I think you could put his name somewhere and search him out in the groups because it's hard to, there's too many pages here.
Yeah, you think that they would have an alphabetical listing or something.
Didn't we unmute him when we muted? No, I guess we didn't. Hey, Brent, get into the queue if you're here. Let me take a look.
I don't know what he comes in as, though. I don't think he always comes in with the same.
I thought he came in as Brent.
Yeah, he did. He came in on Skype, and we identified him as Brent. Brent, star 6 to get into the queue, and we'll unmute you.
Did we ever give him host?
Yeah, he needs to make contact with Jan to get access.
Yeah, because we could find him as a host, you know what I mean? It would make
right. Right.
Well, if he signs in on his cell phone, it doesn't work, does it?
No.
Well, I think you could sign in as a host, can't you, on your phone?
I'm not sure.
Let's look into that.
You can. I believe you can. Then you come in like me. It says NLO, but it says host.
All right. Well, Brent, if you're here, get into the queue. We're going to move on to Q&A until we find him.
I don't see him anymore.
Isn't there a place where you can type his name in and look for him in the route? I thought there was. Huh?
I haven't found that yet.
I thought there was a way to do that. Because you have to go page after page after page.
Yeah, there's a search right here. When you hit attendee list, it says search.
Okay, I put him on, I put his name, Brent I-N, on his number. And so if you hit the collar button...
I got
button,
him.
So
I got him.
Okay.
He's unmuted now. You unmuted, Brent? Brent, you're unmuted. Can you hear me? Calling Brent.
I don't hear him. Something.
Yeah, but I did unmute him. Maybe he's away from his phone. Maybe he's muted on his end. You could be muted on your end, like I told you to mute yourself, maybe.
He's unmuted on mine.
Yeah, but he's coming in on Skype. He could be muted on Skype.
On Skype, he could, yeah.
Yeah. All right, what we'll do is we'll move on, and in a little while we'll look for him again, and if he's there, you can announce him and bring him in.
Okay. But, you got Dan from Carolina's up. Did you open him up, or was he there?
I didn't open him up, no.
Oh, because it says Dan from Carolina's.
I'm going to leave Brent unmuted, though, but go ahead.
It says he's unmuted, Dan. He's are you there, Dan?
Yes, sir, if you got me unmuted. But with Mr. Brent, if you catch him, by all means, let's get Brent online as a total, very respectable respect.
He just came in under another number. Hold on. Let me try to unmute him. How's that, Brent? Can you now talk?
I can talk. Can you hear
there
me?
There you go. Yeah. We can hear you.
Wow. All right.
Okay, let's why don't you mute yourself, Dan? When Brent's done, you can take as the first caller so we don't lose you. Just mute yourself. Meanwhile,
yes,
Brent, are you ready to take the mic for a while?
Cocked and loaded.
Okay. All right. This is Brent Allen Winters. He's the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic.
Thank you so much. My comments are my own, as always, and I'm grateful for the opportunity that these men here afford me to talk a little bit. We've been going through the Constitution of the United States after we finished the Declaration of 76. In light of the call the other night, I listened. I didn't say anything, but I listened, and I said, probably be a good idea to go back through the booklet called Militia of the Several States, Our Constitution's Answer to Its Enemies, Foreign and Domestic. And during the call last night, I, of course, heard what I hear a lot from sincere men and women. When they think of the militia, they think of the Second Amendment. And the Second Amendment is the foundation of the militia of the several states. But without the other three clauses, the militia of the several states never operates lawfully. Indeed, it can't. You don't have to, well, we need to make ourselves known if we're part of the militia, but it's impossible as a matter of law to join the militia. Why is it impossible to join the militia? I know we say that, and I know what we mean when we say that. You need to make yourself known and be available and all. But you can't join the militia because the militia is something you're born into. Some people that were born, that are my age, were born in states where they received a militia number. Georgia did that. As far as I know, Georgia still does it. Others would have to check. The militia is something that you are. If you're a male and you're able-bodied to carry a weapon in battle, whatever the military-grade weapon is in our times, then you are part of the militia and you don't have an option. The law puts a duty on you to take up your responsibility as a member of that body called the militia. The militia of the several states, our Constitution calls it that because each state has a separate and independent militia in one way, not separate and independent in another. And that comes down to the four, F-O-U-R, militia clauses of our Constitution of the United States. The last of those four militia clauses is the Second Amendment. The Second Amendment doesn't establish the militia. It doesn't even grant any duties to anybody. The Second Amendment is there to protect, it's the government's guarantee to protect the duty, that's what a right is, by the way. We've had people challenge me on that, that's silliness. Rights are duties. And if you don't understand them that way, you have joined the evil empire. Even the word right, etymologically, it's an old Germanic word, still in the German tongue, It means duty. That's what it means. Well, it's important I do this first. To make a distinction between the militia of the several states and the posse comitatus. What is the posse comitatus? Well, posse means able, and by extension it means able-bodied. The posse comitatus is the mustering, comitatus, coming together, Latin. Posse comitatus is the coming together of the able-bodied men. That's what it is. See, you see, there's a close relationship there between that and the militia of the several states. But there is a distinction. There is a difference. And it's important we recognize that difference. we right now do not have any of the bodies, the persons are, that are responsible to do something about the four militia, the three militia clauses. They haven't done anything for 175 years. And Justice Joseph Story of the United States Constitution says that his great fear is that these militia clauses, the three, the first three of them, will be forgotten. Justice Joseph Story of the United States Supreme Court. And he said this in his commentary on the Constitution of the United States. He said, I have a fear. My fear is that these will be ignored. And when they're ignored, what will happen is both the politium and the reality of our freedom will be lost. The politium and the reality. Big word, politium. What does it mean? If you remember, if you're old enough, you remember Have Gun, Will Travel, one of the early 1950s TV series. And the star of that series talked about the politium when he first became Have Gun, Will Travel. That was what he wrote on his business card. It was a Western. The politium is an old word that means the sign or the badge of something. The sign of our freedom is the gun we carry. The reality of our freedom is are then being mustered and being available for the militia. There is no militia of the several states that's effective unless the duty of able-bodied men to keep and bear arms is protected. Now, people say, and this was brought up the other night, and it was a good point, one of the men said it, if you're beyond the age of the militia, traditionally about age 45, you don't have a duty to take up arms anymore. But that doesn't mean you can't. That's a good point. And by the way, that's true of the female of our species also. She doesn't have an affirmative duty to take up arms. Indeed, it would be foolish to require such a thing. The militia exists so that she can do her job, which is much more. It's the reason for all of this, is what the female, the species, the law charges her to do in her jurisdiction. But it doesn't mean that she cannot arm herself. Indeed, she needs to learn to, because she is the protector of the home. That's God's design, the protector of the home. Not keep her at home as much, that's an antiquated phrase, but home guard, maybe that'd be a good one. Home guard, that can mean a lot of things. Well, but back to the militia. That's where we need to start. So when you go, and this is what the men said the other night, when you go to your sheriff, you say, I'm available. If you need me, I'm here. You're not technically saying, I'm here for militia duty. You're technically saying, under the law, under our common law, the law of our land, our Constitution of the United States, you're saying, if you need the posse, I'm here. The posse, that's short for posse comitatus. Same bunch of fellows, the able-bodied men. It's just that the sheriff has the authority to assemble the posse. I read a case, and I need to look this case up. It was a case from the 1960s and the race riots that overtook our country. I believe it was from the city of Baltimore. And a lot of property was destroyed, damaged, and people were injured. And many people sued the city of Baltimore. I don't remember all of the details of what the excuses of the city of Baltimore were for not protecting the citizens of Baltimore, but had something to do with a contract, and they didn't have authority to control the police. And you know what the court finally said to the city of Baltimore? They lost. And they said, even if that's true, that under the contract, the way it was arranged, you didn't have the ability to control the police, you did have the authority to assemble a posse. And you never did it. Therefore, you're liable. You had the authority to assemble the posse comitatus, and you didn't do it. You're liable. That case needs to be brought out and talked about. And there are others like it, by the way. That's not the only one. The posse is part of our common law tradition. The able-bodied men of the vicinity. The sheriff in your county has the power, if you're fortunate enough to still have a sheriff, And unlike a couple of states, or at least one I've heard about on the East Coast, the sheriff has the power to assemble the posse. The posse, it seems, is the place to start. That's the place to start. If the sheriff can show that he has the authority to assemble the posse, then that would arise in people's minds that there's something that we need here that we don't have. Indeed, these three militia clauses are sleeping. I'm going to tell you one story quickly that happened right in my neck of the woods when I was 20 years old. And what happened was this. It has to do with the posse and the sheriff. Remember, the posse, same bunch of fellows, but assembled under a little bit of a different authority. To put it bluntly, the president of the United States and the governors of the states, each of the states, have concurrent, that means jurisdiction at the same time, to muster the militia. The president has the authority under the militia clause of our Constitution, one of those three militia clauses, to assemble, to muster the entire militia of the United States, or of a few states, or of one state, or of a part of any state, or parts of any state. Any part of the militia he wants to muster, he can do that. He has authority to do that if it's for the purposes the Constitution outlines in the militia clauses of the United States. And the governors within their own states have the authority to muster the militia of the entire state or any part of the states. And whoever, by the way, does so first in any given instance gets control of the militia at that point. And again, the individual militiaman doesn't have the option under law to say no. No, he has a duty to muster when he's summoned. One more footnote I need to drop. There's so much to say. I want to try to keep it organized. The National Guard is not the militia of the several states. Those that say it is are flat wrong, and they're making a poor substitute for the militia. The militia is different. The National Guard is a voluntary organization. Men volunteer into it. The militia is not a voluntary organization. No, you are the militia. If the governments in the United States take every gun in the United States and they throw every able-bodied male in jail, even if they did that, they wouldn't get rid of the militia of the several states, because all those men in jail are still the militia of the several states according to our law. And let me give you this story quickly, and Lord willing, next week we'll move into those four militia clauses. By the way, those four militia clauses concern the duties of presidents of the United States. That's one militia clause. The second militia clause concerns the duties of the Congress of the United States respecting the militia. The third militia clause concerns the duties of the governors and state legislatures of each of the states concerning the militia within their state. All of that dovetails together, and the foundation of it is the Second Amendment, that men remain armed. Well, back when I was about 20 years old, in that county where I was from, which is in the Wabash Valley and adjacent to a very unionized town. Matter of fact, this town is where the railroad unions, where Eugene Debs lived, and the railroad unions started in this town. Not that big a town, but it was a railroad town. And also, the coal mine union started not far from there, John Lewis, south of there in the coal mines in southern Illinois. This is in Terre Haute, Indiana. But it was heavily unionized, and there was a motorcycle gang over there. A motorcycle gang. And the name of the gang was the Cloven Hooves. I think they're still there, but they're not as rough as they were back then. Well, they thought they were rough anyway. The story reveals otherwise. But they were headed to Iron Bridge Road, which is on the low side of the Wabash River, for a weekend of drinking and who knows what else. It's out in the bottoms, out in the hinterlands. And to get there, they had to cross over the river, and they had to come down through a little settlement that's unincorporated called West Union. And this, they were in the little county there where I was from. And there's one diner in West Union, one diner. And they were hungry and probably drunk and had the munchies on top of it, I don't know, but they stopped. And when they pulled into the gravel parking lot with their Harley 74s and 45s, the owner, mom and pop operation, he saw them. And he told his wife, go lock the door, and I'm going to get on the telephone. He goes back in the kitchen and gets on the telephone, and he calls the neighbors and tells them that some rough-looking characters pulled up in the parking lot. And by that time, his wife was at the door. She'd locked it and put the closed sign on the window, and they had come to the door, and they banged on the door, and she said, we're closed, so you'll have to come back later. Well, one of them was stupid enough, for whatever reason, to kick the glass out of the bottom of the door with his boot and put some glass in her leg. And after that happened, by the time it had happened, they turned around and noticed there were a few men there with shotguns. And the word was getting around real quick through the party lines. We had party lines back then, and if you called somebody, everybody knew whose ring it was, and they'd get on the phone and get the news. And so within a very short period of time, Red Simpson was alerted. He was sheriff at that time. Now, he was about, county seat was at the most 20 minutes away. Well, he hightailed it down there, going about 90 or more. He got there. He got there quick. And by that time, more men had gathered with shotguns, and they had these fellas surrounded, and they just stood around them and waited. And the sheriff showed up. One kid showed up with a hunting bow, an arrow bow, and he asked the sheriff, Red Simpson, what to do, and he said, well, you get on that little building across the road, that old cinder block building. It was about, the roof was about caved in, and he said, you get up on top of that building, and you don't do anything until I tell you to, and if I don't tell you to do anything, don't do anything, and if you do anything, I'm going to have you jailed without my orders. And he told the other men there that they were not to do anything without his orders. And one of them did, and turned out to be okay, but he told these bikers to get out of town and don't come back. He was really being nice about it. He could have arrested them. He didn't. The situation was really ugly by that time because this one had kicked this glass in. And they got kind of mouthy, and it wasn't long before one or two of them got on their bikes and kicked their starters and fired up their bikes, and they got to shuffling around knowing that the men there had the drop on them. But one of them got really mouthy after everybody else had pulled away, and he said that they were going to come back and burn that whole damn town down. And that really ticked off one of the men, and he had a 12-gauge shotgun. And this fellow was sitting on his bike. He was trying to start it, and it wouldn't kick over as quick as he wanted it to, and he just leveled his shotgun at the sprocket on his 74 Harley and pulled the trigger, the sprocket on the back wheel. And he put the shot right about in the middle of it, and he ruined the wheel, ruined the sprocket, and he peppered this fella in with quite a bit of buckshot in his buttocks and around his leg. Well, he got off his bike because it knocked him down, and he finally picked it back up. Of course, it was messed up, and he got on a bike with the other fellow that stayed with him. And they took off down the road, went to the neighboring town, and he found a doctor and got treatment. That was the Posse Comitatus under the control of the sheriff. By the way, they never came back again, never that I have ever heard. That sheriff knew what he was doing. He was an old fella. Everybody knew Red. It was a small county of less than 10,000 people. Just had a couple of towns in it. That's the Posse Comitatus under the control of the sheriff. The militia clauses do not apply to the Posse Comitatus, and their sleeping militia clauses, we're not using them, but I want to read them, and then I'll turn it back over to Gerard. I want to read these four militia clauses in order, and then we maybe, Lord willing, we can go through them one at a time. The first militia clause is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15, and goes through 16, says this. Remember I talked about the Congress, the presidents, and the state governments. It says this, the Congress shall have the power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. See, here's the reasons. To execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States. Now, this doesn't say Congress can call out the militia. Listen to it close. It says Congress has the power to provide for calling out the militia. In other words, they have the power to interpret these reasons for calling out the militia and tell the President of the United States the standard he has to apply when he thinks there's a reason under the Constitution to call out the militia. The second militia clause is about the power of the states, and it says this: reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. See, Congress has the power to prescribe the discipline of the militia so it will be the same throughout the throughout all of the 50 states. But the second militia clause says the states, only the states can appoint their own officers. The federal government can't do that. And only the states can train the militia, provide for the training, set the standard. Okay, third militia clause, that's about the president. So we got the Congress, that's the first militia clause. The second militia clause is about the states, their responsibility. The third militia clause is about the presidents of the United States. It says this: the president shall be commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. Martial law applies to the militia when mustered, not before. Martial law applies to the militia once mustered. Once a man is mustered, he's not under our common law anymore. He's under martial law. Right now, the way it stands and the way the law is, that'd be the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That's what all of our armed forces becomes, because it says here, called into the actual service. They're part of the armed forces of the United States when called into actual service, when the president does it, when the governor does it. They're part of the armed forces of the state. Fourth militia clause. This is the one you're familiar with so well. We all are. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people, to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Remember, the preamble of our Constitution cites the people. It says we, the people. The people are the producers of, the creators of, the Constitution. Put in the reverse, the Constitution of the United States is a creature, to use the language of our common law. The Constitution is a creature of the people of the United States. Who are the people of the United States? The militia. The people of the United States are the militia, and the militia of the United States is the people. That's the meaning of those words in our Constitution of the United States. And so it is of great significance that the people, the creators of the Constitution of the United States, are the ones that are members of this group called the militia. That's the simplicity of it. Four clauses. One clause deals with that class of persons called congressmen. The next clause deals with that class of persons called those in state government. The third clause deals with that class of persons called presidents of the United States, and the fourth militia clause deals with that class of persons called the people of the United States. They each have a responsibility. It is a duty, a bounden duty. Now, the fourth militia clause protects a duty that is fundamental. That's called a fundamental duty, one that comes straight from your maker, your God, your creator, right on you, without any mediating institution. These other militia clauses are authority delegated from God himself to the people of the United States through the Constitution and to these officers of government. That's delegated power. The Second Amendment doesn't talk about delegated power. It talks about protecting power that God has provided. What is it? It is your right, your duty, to defend yourself from murder or maiming, to defend your family from destruction. That's why the Second Amendment is there, so that government won't mess with God-given fundamental rights, as they are called. Well, that's enough for now, but I want to say this at the end, and then I'll turn it back over. I encourage all of you, no sense in not taking advantage of what other people may have learned. You should get the book called Militia of the Several States, A Common Lawyer Comments, Militia of the Several States, written by yours truly. It's not very long. It's graspable. It's only 100 pages. Doesn't need to be any longer than that. There have been men that have written massive volumes on the militia. Too much minutia. Too much. I don't need it. None of us need it. What we need is the simplicity of these four clauses. And get this book. You can find the book at commonlawyer.com. Commonlawyer.com. And when you go to commonlawyer.com, go to the books button, and you can scroll down there and see where to click. The book is available. I think that website takes you when you click on the link to Amazon.com, and you can order it there. If you have trouble ordering it, you don't know how, write a letter. Go to commonlawyer.com and go to the contacts page. If you email on that contacts page and say you want a book, it'll tell you what to, or somebody will tell you how to do it, what to do, and how to do it. But get that book. It's a little book. It's affordable, and it in the back has a model state militia statute so that your state legislature can have something to look at, maybe incite them to do something, do their duty under the Constitution. They're not doing it, haven't done it clearly for at least 150, if not 175 years. And if the militia of the several states, these clauses were acted upon, it would do a whole lot to get rid of our problems. The police state would fade away if we would do this. Back to you, Gerard.
Okay, thank you, Brent. Appreciate that. Okay, so next week we'll go through the clauses. Sounds like a plan. Dan, you're still unmuted. Unmute yourself and you can begin with whatever question or statement you may have. Are you still there? Dan from the Carolinas, you are up. Hello, hello. I know you were there before Brent came on, so. And you.
Am I unmuted?
There you go. Now you are.
Very good.
Yeah, okay.
I don't believe I've ever heard such profound, great, concise with clarity presentments in any place that I've been to, a lot of places with having different professionals render a dissertation or a presentment. I tell you tonight from the very beginning, folks, it's an honor to be on this call here, and it's a high tribute to these people that have spoken so far, and I can't say enough. So, at the same token, it should be said a lot that those that may not know that if you guys will give us a certain number to call back to get this recording, and on the same nickel, I think it would be just awesome if we could have a CD-ROM, and I don't know who might would take this on, but I'd certainly like to contribute to it, that we could purchase the complete entirety of presentment tonight. I think it's there. This is an archive. This is history being made, folks, right before our ears and, of course, our eyes, too, and in our daily affairs. And it's an archive that should be available to us, and it would certainly help if we would have an organization that could take on that little situation of doing a CD-ROM, and it could contribute funds, you know, reasonably backed justly and support NationalLibertyAlliance.org and the cause. It's really cause is, tell it like it is. With that said, there has been at times that I've known of a company that could be hearing the conversation with their instruments. I don't know where this is. but it's with the telephone ingenuity of some of our companies that can hear simultaneously the voice while it's being presented by the presenter and simultaneously type. If we know who that is and what they might could do and the capabilities, this might be just God sent to recognize this. With that said, last week there was a couple from South Carolina, and I believe I've heard those people before, and I won't be with the lengthy at this because we're at 10:42, and I want to be very fair to other there to get in all the people tonight as if we can. So with that said, there was some people that mentioned about a 80% possible ownership of an estate. And I'll sure tell you, they were given everything by Mr. John and Gerard and team into a remedy. However, my suggestion is if those parties somehow would be able to send a, whether it be an affidavit or at least some facts to authorize and show authority that there's 80% is supposed to come, whether it's in a will or just however, to this particular family, and then there's some other siblings they mentioned. Well, there's one way that possibly could happen is that they could ask for a court-ordered surveyor to come into play, or commissioners for that matter, to separate what is the 80%. A lot of people that write wills, they put 80%, but they don't designate where the 80%, if there's land or structure, the boundaries. They don't give this. And so, at the same token, that would be fair to the other siblings. And then that 80% would not be what you call involved with a joinder of law with someone else in the family. And so that would simplify things that they could then move on with their life and say, this 80% is exactly me. I'm not having complications from a legal standpoint with a joinder of law of some of the other siblings as to what that could entail legalities. So I hope that might have helped those parties. And I turn this call back over to you guys.
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate that, Dan.
So well.
And by the way, we do have the archives that anybody can go and download any weeks. We have them on the site on the Monday night call. And you can download them to your computer, and you can burn CDs on your computer if you're savvy enough. Or even DVDs, you know. So they're out there. You know, it is available. And the technology today, most people can capture that. You know, that's old. It's actually now that's old technology. It's still there, though. Anybody that wants this call, you go on and you look up the Monday night call archives, and they're in there by date. You can, and the whole 3 hours is on there. So, and we do that because some people can't make Monday night, and they have to catch this thing when they can catch it, and so then what they do is they listen to the recorded version, and it is on the National Liberty Alliance website, just so you know.
Outstanding.
I think it's a very simple thing if you download it to your computer, and then pop in a readable, writable CD, and point it to that, and it will burn it for you in there. Just if in case you got one that you want to make to carry with you, because it's good, because if you go out and go to a meeting or something, and you could play some of that, maybe there's something here that's pertinent to what you're doing. So at least if you have a CD, or you can give them out at your meetings. You can hand them out, and that would get our word out, you know, even more so. So that's a good idea by Dan. I appreciate that. Okay.
Just one second here. I want to plug the many times while Mr. John has been behooving us, folks, let's get out there and sign up and get to become trained, especially start with the committee men. And because we are our neighbor's keeper, in a sense, and we're doing a big service to our own families and our own self to become educated, like Mr. John is behooving us, and Gerard, and gosh, Mr. Brent, and others. And not only that, the administrator positions here. So, and two, I'll certainly want to, Mr. Jan, if you're on, I think you are, I'll certainly want to help mail some of those notices, I believe, that Mr. John was talking about out to some of the judges and so forth.
Okay, thank you very much for that. That's the kind of help, you know, we need help. So that's nice.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Okay,
you're
we got Stephen from Oklahoma. I'm going to unmute you. You are unmuted. Are you there?
Hello, gentlemen. I had a question that came to me a few days ago, and it was for the position of a committeeman to be able to interview and to call back somebody who would be an elected official. There's a thing where they have elected officials and then appointed officials. So how would it deal with the appointed officials?
I don't quite understand where you're going with that. You say you have elected officials and appointed officials. Appointed officials are unpaid. Appointed them, he can fire them, unappoint them.
Yeah, I understand his question, Gerard.
The appointed is like you have a political appointed, somebody who's not officially appointed by the people.
Yeah, I understand your question. The question he's basically asking is, you know, how do you deal with a person that's appointed in response to a person that is elected? The committeeman can recall an elected individual, but they can't recall an appointed individual. And therein is the key. The elected individual, that's why one of the things we're going to be researching is all appointed individuals and who actually appoints them. Of course, most of the appointments of a lot of people on the federal level is done by the president. But there are certain people that are elected in certain positions, and they have the power, the authority to appoint people to certain positions. Well, you go after the person who's responsible. The person who's responsible is the elected individual that appointed that person. You go to that person, and you let them know, look, go fix this problem, because if you can't fix it, we'll have to send someone into your position that can fix this problem. And that's how you deal with that. That's how the committeeman can do that. What people need to understand is how powerful the committeeman is. You got to understand something. Let's just take the county chairman, okay? And it can even be a town chairman. It depends on what the election is, you know, if it's a town individual that's been elected or maybe someone on a state level. So if it's whatever it is, it's on a state level. The county chairman, okay, makes a call to an individual that they put onto the ballot and lets them know, I want to meet with you and talk. We've got a few things we need to talk about. And you work out an appointment, that person will be there. And whatever that committee man tells them that they're violating or they're doing, they will obey. I mean, it's political suicide if they don't, because that committee man has the power to go back to the other committee man, explain the problem, and say, hey, maybe we should recall this guy. What do you think? And if they can get enough people together to say, yeah, let's pull him out, then they can recall him. You see, that's the power of that's government by consent. Right there is government by consent. We can remove these people. And then, of course, there's the other side of the coin, which, of course, is the grand jury that can indict. But if a crime is committed, like taking funny money, okay, that's a bribe, they can indict.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, that was something that was in the realm of confusion for me. Okay, thank you, John.
Okay, very good. So if we're done there, we'll unmute Kimberly. I don't know what state you're from. I have your last name. But
hi, can you hear me?
Yeah. Where are you from? What state?
California.
Okay, very good.
My question was, and I don't know if you've addressed it or not yet, can you be a jury administrator and a committeeman as well? Because I originally wanted to be a jury administrator.
Yes, you can be a jury administrator and a committeeman. There's no impediment there, so to speak.
Okay, because I wanted to do both. The more you guys talk about the committeeman, I really think that's a job that's going to require a lot of integrity, especially the state that I'm in.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of cleanup that we have to do here, and I'm really excited to get started with it. So right now I'm in the government for consent, and I'm partially taking some of the civics. I'm doing them simultaneously, so I'm
good.
Excited.
Very
so thank
good,
you.
Yeah.
Thank you for all the hard work you guys are doing. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Kimberly, for that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have Linda from Virginia. You've been unmuted. Go ahead. Are you there?
Can you hear me?
I can now, yes.
Okay. My question is sort of related to the IRS case.
Yeah.
And what about state tax? Because I received a notice for, if you can believe this, for 2003 and 2006. So here I am. I'm not even sure where those, my documents for Virginia. I know state is a different thing because they're like a creditor, right?
Well, yeah, I have not heard, and it doesn't mean that they don't do this because they probably do some places, but New York, I haven't seen them do it anyway, at least here in New York. I haven't heard them really chasing people because they rely really on the IRS to do all the chasing and pushing and scaring, and then they figure you're going to comply. I'm not sure on that, but again, they're doing is following suit with a direct tax, which is unlawful, and it'd be funny, but look at, you take that into federal court because that's a violation of your right of due process, and they don't have the authority to come out after you and place a direct tax on you, and so I wonder how that would fare out.
Well,
they've already
make sure that you file the federal because they base the state qualification.
Yeah, I think you're right on that.
In other words,
well,
if
they're claiming
tax, they're looking for you to file state. If you did federal, they automatically know that you're a taxpayer according to their definition of a taxpayer, which means you should be filing with them. But look, if unless they can prove fraud, you don't have to keep those papers for 19 years. That's a bunch of baloney. 2003 was almost 18 years ago.
That's what I said. And
you don't have to keep, unless they're going to prove that you committed that. Look, there's no statute of limitations on fraud. So if they're asking information on 2003, you say, look, this is beyond. Go away, leave me alone. And it's ridiculous that they would even ask for such a thing.
They've already sent me a notice of lien, which they filed in Richmond with some strange bank. I don't even know who it is.
Are you sure that this is the real IRS and that is just not a scam? There's a lot of scams out there.
No, it's not IRS. It's the state.
Well,
state
okay,
tax.
So state income tax. But what's the agency that's...
they do contract that out. They contract it out to,
I'm telling you right now that's probably some baloney company. Get the address, call them, if you call somebody, get the phone number to call them back and get very specific information and say, well, I'm going to check you out with my state attorney general. I don't believe that they're for real because I'm telling you the scams out there are unbelievable. And I can't see the state going back 18 years asking you for information. They put some phishing site and they make it look all official, and they're hoping to scare you into sending them a check. I think it's a scam.
Did they do it by letter or phone?
It's by notice. Notice of a lien. Notice of a lien.
Yeah, where
notice
is
the lien? Of a lien. Wow.
Yeah.
I'll go down to the clerk.
It
wasn't for my bank. It was for something they just dreamed up. I think it was in Richmond, and I don't have any account at that bank.
No. Notice
but 2003, I'm not worried about because it's just a couple hundred dollars, but I'm wondering from 2003 to 2018, what could that possibly be? I don't even know why they're charging it.
Notice of lien means that they're filing a lien against you. It has nothing to do with your bank or where your money's at. What it means is that they got a public recording of a lien that they're putting against you for back taxes. You don't have to be connected, and if they told you where the bank is or whatever.
No, it says they're leaning your funds at that account, at that facility.
And you don't have an account there?
Okay.
No, No, never have.
Well, that's very interesting. You may be another person with the same name as you, and they feed that up, but
people steal your
Gerard, you need to go out and raise your mic level, because you are really so low compared to everyone else.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, is everyone else hearing them low?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he'd go over. You know how to get to your mic, don't you?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Meanwhile, I'll talk a little bit on this. Look at
the 2006. Is past the statute of limitations
Besides, they don't care about any of that anyway. The courts don't care. They're going to do whatever they please. They don't. It's a shame. That's why we're doing what we're doing. We need to do it quickly. But look at what you need to do here is, first of all, if they're claiming there's a lien, that there's a lien on that account.
Yeah, it said on the notice that they're gonna lien any funds in that account at that bank.
And that bank you don't recognize or anything?
No, no, it's in Richmond. I've never been. It did say on the back, because everything I get is like pension or,
but what you need
money
to do is make sure that there's no financial institution you signed into that leads back to that. Are you sure that there's nothing that you have that leads back to that institution?
No, I don't know.
And what county is so Richmond? It'd be Richmond County, I think. Richmond. What county are you in?
I'm all the way north by D.C.
Hmm. Well, go down to your county. Go down to your county and see if there's a lien against you. You just go ask the clerk, it'd be a little on the safe side.
Well, I can look that up myself.
Okay, so make sure there's no lien against you or anything there. Now, I don't know how they can lien an account without liening you, really. Well, they lien the account, but they have to go after you and give you a notification that they have made a lien.
My thing is, can they go back that far? That's ridiculous.
Well, again, they do whatever they want. They're lawless. You know, look, whatever the state does, the courts are going to back up, and that's it.
I did see, I actually did, before this happened, I saw a couple postings to the same thing, talking about it going back years and years ago. One was for a daughter and her grandmother or something, and she was like, how am I going to find her records for this, you know? And it might have been on your program, I don't know, but anyway...
They'll do whatever they want to do because they're lawless. They have no fear of the people. They're not worried. They're protected. They're above the law. They don't care. They'll do anything they want. They think that they can't be held accountable because they're protected. You see, that's what, of course, what we're doing here. We need that protection is being removed by Trump, and we're going to go after these people. Once that protection is moved, you know, the hammer's coming down.
But could I to this note, it did say on the back to let them know if any of this was basically pensions or, and I could go back and say,
yeah,
yes,
I'd be a little concerned. You know, look, Gerard has a point here. You know, this is so far out of the norm. Why don't you go look at the address and look at that, what are they coming as a state, or how are they coming out after you? What's the title of, who are these people?
I think they are coming as the state. I don't have it in front of me.
Well, get it. Take a look. If it's coming at the state,
they contracted out, John.
Oh, they contracted out?
They contracted out.
Oh, yeah. Forget about it. That's a con job.
It's a baloney thing.
Yeah, that's a con job.
It's a con job. I'm telling
you.
Yeah, but don't they still have power to?
No, it's a con. They're trying to get you to call to get some money out of you.
That's right. The power they have is whatever you grant them.
You know what?
Send them a cease and desist, or you're going to have this.
No. Call them up and tell them and see what they want when they ask for money. Record this thing and then go down to the sheriff. Take your paper and your recording, go down to the sheriff.
I would call them and get whatever information and say, well, look, I'm not answering anything until I check you out, my state attorney general.
No, I would play ball with them to the degree, say, oh, how much you want? Oh, do you want that much? Well, I think I could do that. Let me get back to you in a week. Let me see what I can raise up, and you know, I really don't want to go to jail. You know, play into it, and then take it and go down to the sheriff. Because, they can't contract a lease.
Look, at most scam artists, boiler room people will not give you a callback number that you can actually reach them because they're in hiding. They're working out of some hotel suite somewhere. And if you just call them and then you say, well, give me a number to call you back. I can't talk right now. Let me call you back. That's the first step to figuring out if it's a scam. So unless they're very savvy and they got a good thing worked out, they won't give you a callback number because it's too easy.
Well, I think they got a game going. They got a game going on with these phone numbers because I've gotten lots of calls and I've tried to call these people back, you know, when I miss a call or something, and there is no such number. So I know somebody, hiding their number to begin with.
With the caller ID.
But they
do. I'm telling you get a number from them and say, let me call you back. And usually that number is no good.
Yeah, but they do somehow. They probably have a way to move this around or whatever it is they do. I really don't know. But they do. Some of these people do have phone numbers. You can call them back. I've seen a lot of the things on YouTube, for instance, where they're exposing the scammer. And they're calling the people back to make the arrangements. And they get them on the phone. And they get tell them, go down to the store and get a cash card and do this and do that. You know, it's crazy stuff, and people go do it. They get scammed. But
if you can call them back, that's the first step for the FBI to trace them.
Well, that's true. I don't know how they beat it, but
they could trace them. And unless they're a very sophisticated scam, they don't want to give you a callback number. You know what I mean? They'll give you a callback number if they're not going to be there 24 hours from now. They don't care. They got burner phones. You know what I'm saying? So you'll find out within 24 hours. They're not going to stick around, wait for some state attorney general to find out who they are and where they are. Because, they contract this stuff out, right, to some company, some baloney company. The people that work for that contract company get your information, and then they run a scam on you. They may be somebody who has a legitimate contract with the state government to collect things, and then they go out on the side and make their own money. You know what I mean? I mean, there's nothing that surprises me today. So just ask some questions and see. Like John says, let them show you documentation. Where's the lien? Show me the lien. Where's it filed? I want a copy.
That might be a good idea. I'm aggravated. I can find everything but that.
Anyway, I don't think you got to worry about it too much. I don't. I think if you just did a couple things that they would, if they think you're savvy and you're asking too many questions or whatever, they'll disappear on their own. They won't want to deal with you if you're asking questions that they can't answer. And as a matter of fact, if you don't want to deal with them, what you do is call them up and go down to the sheriff's office or the local police. And let one of the sergeants or somebody talk to them. Say, well, she's worried about your qualifications and whether you're a scam or not. We're going to look into you. Give me. I need your ID. I need to know who you are, and I need to put you in my police computer here and see what they say.
Yeah, I was surprised because it's the bank I've never even heard of, in Richmond.
But listen,
I've never
don't forget, in. Somebody could have stole your number and used it. The illegal immigrants do that all the time, and the IRS knows it. They claim that you have at least seven other people using your number, and they don't even – they know that seven people can't use the same Social Security number, but they never investigate it because guess what? They're collecting money. Those people – in other words, you can't get a job unless your employer takes out – your Social Security and stuff, and the immigrants don't care. They're getting their salary, and they're not going to file a tax return, and they're not going to get their Social Security. So that's windfall profits for the government. So they kind of facilitate that fraud by not investigating it. So seven people could be using your Social Security number, and the IRS is never going to look into it. That's a fact.
I'm just concerned that they do have some kind of power, and that if they do find... where I
You ever see that? You ever see that tape that the Supreme Court judge put out? And he said, "Never talk to the cops." I think it's on the website. Well, guess what? I'm going to tell you the same thing. They only have the power that you give them by your consent. So you don't have to worry. And I mean, if they have anything and they're going to do anything, then let them do it. I mean, they're not. I don't see that. You know, they're giving you some bank from some place that you don't even know. You know, say, "Oh, good, I need that information because I need to get that money out of there right now." You know what I mean? Hey, come on. If they think they can lead an account, that means there's money there, no?
Well, they did list
money you didn't know you had.
They did list. There was another year, and that I do owe, which I'm going to pay, you know, but I don't have any problem with that. But so they've mixed it in together. These 2 years
yeah,
that were
that means they have access to something. I mean, you know, like I said, they contract this stuff out, and then maybe one of the employees sold your information to some scam artist, and so then he has some valid stuff to make you think he's legit, because they have it. Look at these government offices; their records get hacked all the time. Hacked.
Oh, you know what? Actually, now I remember. I didn't remember at the beginning when they first sent me this notice. They had some huge amount on there, and I sent back and told them that I didn't owe that, and they took most of it off of there.
Listen, you got to be careful what you tell them anyway, because we've had one of
them. Oh, I know.
We had somebody here that got that the IRS came after. And they had a check that was written to them, but it was written to the person and the homeowner. And so they put, let's say it was a $200,000 check. So the government said, "We're going to lien you for $200,000. So he called them back and said, "Well, first of all, that check was in both our names, so the most I could have got was half of it." So you know what they did? They turned around and knocked it down to half and sent them the bill back, because he volunteered the information to them that I could only get half. And they said, "Okay, so now you owe us half." I mean, he didn't say he owned it. He said, how could you lien me for the whole thing when the check's in two people's names? So
yeah, I don't think they can touch accounts that are commingled like that.
Yeah, that was me, Gerard, and I won that case. That was the one we went out.
I wasn't going to reveal it was you.
No, well, I told the story earlier.
Maybe I didn't hear that. I just got in late. So, but yeah, so you know, any information you give them, they can and will use against you. Every cop tells people that. Anything you say can and will be used against you. And what they don't tell you is, even if we have to use it fraudulently, that's the caveat to that. So just be careful. You know, I mean, every time you open your mouth, you take a chance of sticking your foot in. You know, I had a case that I won the case through default, had the default registered with the clerk, and the judge held the hearing, and we went in there, and so I said, "Well, it's defaulted this, that case over this and that." And so the judge says, "We collected my papers and I'm getting ready to walk out of the room." He says, "What do you want me to do?" I said, "Well, you should dismiss it." Well, that gave him permission to open the case up again, because I had it defaulted. And when I said dismiss it, so he took an opportunity to rule against me, because I gave him permission when I said you should dismiss it. If he can dismiss it, he can also not dismiss it. And that's exactly what he did based on my words in there, because I didn't keep my stupid mouth shut. So just that's another lesson for you.
Well, I did call them to try to find out what was going on, and you know, the thing is, here's the thing I'm really aggravated. I'm not, the 2003, like I said, is just so, it's low amount. I'm not too concerned about that. But the 2006, they're claiming that I never filed. And I did file. I've filed every year. And the thing is, in 2009, they said I didn't file. And I sent them, you know, a notice. I sent them a copy of what I filed, and then I never heard from them again until just now. So So this
well,
is
listen,
like a...
By sending that them a copy of what you filed, if you sent that to a scam company, they got all your information. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you're giving them information.
No, they really... No, they don't. They don't have anything.
Well, if you send them a copy of your tax return, it kind of has your information on it, doesn't it? Your Social Security number and stuff like that.
Yeah, it has my Social Security number, but that's
there you
it.
Go. Bang. You gave it to them.
Well, I don't think they can access anything that way, at least not yet anyway.
That's how they steal your identity. They get your Social Security number. You kidding me? That everybody needs a Social Security number as ID. They say it's not ID, it is ID. I mean, that's why they took it off the driver's licenses, because they were stealing people's ID with their Social Security
but,
number.
You know,
okay, if I have your Social Security number, I can use it, and I can set up a fake account and get a job, pretend I'm you, and have the deductions taken out, and then, you know, and that's what a lot of illegal aliens do.
What really aggravates me about this is that was back when everyone was starting to file online. And I filed my, you know, I filed my return and everything, and I printed it, and it looked funny to me, but I thought, what do I know? You know what I mean? This is an online thing. So I sent it to them. And somehow, this thing, they just never will process it. I don't know, you know, but it's, but it has the, you know, I'm, it has the numbered lines and everything and the amounts. So why is it that they cannot, and even they're claiming I didn't file. So if I didn't file, what does that mean? I can never file? You know what I mean? I don't know. This is just strange. And it's $1,500. And I think that's, I can't remember if that's within interest or not or what. But all of this seems very strange. It just strikes me as the state trying to just get money out of people, you know?
Did we lose Gerard? I guess we lost him back. All right, anyway. Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, look, be careful with that and make a call. See if there's a phone number on it. Make a call, see what happens, and check the address on the paper with the address what it should be. And I wouldn't worry about it because, you know, I don't know how they would do that. And if you, it's an institution that you have no connection with, so.
Well, that indicates to me, though, that they are searching for assets, it seems like. Or maybe they just made it up.
Well,
I don't know.
You know, you said it was contracted out to somebody?
Well, no, I just know that, no, it looked official. I'm pretty sure.
All right, well, check in
sure
and make the calls.
On
and,
Commonwealth of Virginia or whatever. But I just know that they contract the collection.
Well, look, make the call. Go out online, check the address, see if the address is the same, see if the phone number is the same, and make the call and see how what happens. And then just don't, you know, say, you know, don't hang up. Don't even talk to them. But see how they answer it and see what happens. Well, with that, we've got to take
the
our
number,
next call because it's running late and we've been on this for a while. So, but let us know
number,
how that turns out because I'm kind of interested.
The number that they direct you to call is the Department of Taxation with Virginia. That's where they direct you to call, and that's who I did call. So I was talking to the state after, you know.
Right. Well, look, if there's a lien, why don't you see if you can find out if there's a lien in that county on you, even though you have no connection there, see what comes up. Because it's no lien in your county on you, and there's no lien in that county on you, there's nothing to think about or worry about. So,
yeah.
But with that, we got to move on because it's getting late. We have people on the call.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Gerard, are you back? Did we lose you? Where did you go to? Looks like he's still here. Gerard. All right. Well, until he gets back, I'll take the next caller. Let's see. Let's go to Jim in PA. You got the mic.
Hello, this is Jim in Pennsylvania.
Yep.
Okay, I want to follow up on the gentleman from the Carolinas that wants to disseminate Brent's presentation, you know, on the audio of that. And at one time I talked to NLA and I wanted to find out how I could download the 3-hour conference call.
And just go to, I'll tell you how, go to nationallibertyalliance.org, okay? Go to weekly call, top left side, weekly call, right above the blue bar on the top left side. Scroll down and you'll see all of the calls. Now, if you click on them, they'll play immediately. It'll pop open another page and it'll play it. If you right-click on it, you would go save link as, okay, and then, you know, give it a name, save it on your computer, and it'll be in an MP3.
So I could take this and play it in this 3-hour conference.
You could throw it on your MP3 player. You could throw it on a CD and stick it in a car. You know, as long as you burn it to play in a player, you know, you could put it in a anywhere, your computer, anywhere, you know, probably your phone. It's an MP3. Any place you can play an MP3, and you can put it on a CD to play it in a CD player in a car.
Okay, so John, an MP3 player will accommodate a 3-hour conference call.
Oh, absolutely. I have an MP3 player. I must have, I don't think I'm exaggerating when I'm saying 5,000, 10,000, a lot of audio. I mean, just hours and hours and hours and hours. I got the Federalist, I believe I got both the Anti-Federalist and the Federalist papers in there. I've got the Bible in there. I've got a study in Mark in there. I've got, I don't know how much music in there. But, you know, and my MP3 player cost me maybe $49 or something, you know?
Okay.
You can get a lot. And a lot of these MP3 players, they'll also have these little memory cards. I forget what they call them. But they have the card you can slide in there. Micro something or other. But, yeah, you can put them on your MP3 player. It's 3 hours is nothing.
Okay, I'm very technological illiterate. But anyways, let me follow up with Brent's presentation. He was talking about the militia. Now, I have a question, a hypothetical question for NLA. Back in 2012, we were up in New Hampshire for the New Hampshire primary. We were supporting Ron Paul for president. But anyways, we ran into a gentleman, and this is a hypothetical question, a gentleman that was one of the Occupy Wall Street people, and a young guy. But what he said to me, he said he was an anarchist. Now, I understand we have the freedom of speech, but isn't someone say to you that they are an anarchist, is that not say that they could hit you on the head with a piece of pipe right now because they don't go by any law?
That's exactly what I think it would mean. I know Brent is unmuted, so he can speak on this too. But look, when you get to anarchy, that's a dangerous position to be. We're not lawless people. We are lawful people. But we're for the real law, not the fake law, or we're not under statutes, for instance. We're not under equity. We're under law. Our government is under equity. Commercial activities that we gave the government authority to control and monitor and keep it, keep things flowing, they're under equity. You can go into the Constitution, Article 1, particularly Article 1, Section 8. We'll give a list of 18 powers we gave to Congress to write law. The titles that they have, there are 54 or 57. I keep getting mixed up all the time. Let me see what that was. Tell you exactly how many titles there is. But there's so many titles that we've given authority. 57 titles, okay? And they're all lawful. These titles are lawful. There's one title in here particularly that I don't think is lawful in any way because it doesn't apply to anyone, but it doesn't even make sense. I mean, even for commercial activities, it doesn't make sense, and that would be Title 26. the IRS code. But everything else, we've given them power and authority to do.
This is Terry.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the, when I've interfaced with anarchists, they are okay with rules, but not okay with rulers. So they don't.
Yeah, but that's maybe what they're saying.
Some of them are off the wall.
Yeah, that may be what they're saying, but I've always thought anarchy is just total lawlessness. I mean, maybe I'm wrong on that, but I'll have to look up the meaning of the word and see once. I'm sure there's a legal.
I think there's different flavors. I'll mute now.
Okay. Yeah, well, again, there's that. Look, we're all under the law, and nobody escapes that. Eventually you're going to die. You're under the law. Then there is the control or statutes, which ultimately the only authority of statutes in our nation is in equity law, that we've given them authority under the Constitution to write law for government officials, government agencies, and commercial activities. And that's it. Now, anarchy is, just total lawlessness is what I understand. But I'm going to look that word up and see. I don't know, Brent, if you're here and you want to comment on that, maybe you have an understanding of that word better.
Only if you can hear me.
I can hear you.
Oh, I better quit chewing so loud then.
Yeah, you better do that.
I thought I was off. I think that, Terry makes a point because, I'm one of these word men in the sense that if we don't pay attention to the etymology of words, we lose our lives, our liberties, and our properties because the courts are going to pay attention to that. But anarchist means, by the letters, one who is who acknowledges no ruler.
Right. But God is ruler in the law, so...
That's, you're going to the same place I am. And if you're not going to acknowledge a lawgiver, then you're a godless, lawless man, period.
Right.
If you want to acknowledge some rules that men make, I'm not willing to go along with that. I'm tired of men's rules.
Yeah.
I grew tired of a long time, but the longer I live, the tireder I get. God has given us rules, the laws of nature, and the laws of nature is God. Yeah, you saw the same thing I did. So Terry's right about the etymology of the word, but also to say that is to say that you have no rules without a ruler. There must be a lawgiver, and every person has one, whether they understand it or not. A lawgiver, a final arbiter of right and wrong in individual instances from whose decision there is no appeal. And that's what James says that the maker of heaven and earth is. He calls him the one true lawgiver.
All right, and here is Black's Law on this. It says, absence of government, state of society where there is no law or supreme power. Of course, God is our supreme power, and he is, we're under that law. So, lawlessness or political disorder, destructive of and confusion in government. And that was a Supreme Court interpretation of its meaning, and it holds up in Black's Law. And when you just go out online and look it up, which you really can't trust those dictionaries too much there, but if you go up and look at anarchy online, it says a state of disorder due to absence or non-recognition of authority. And again, God is our authority. Our courts that are supposed to be representing God through the trial juries, that is our authority. The law of the land is our authority. And we placed ourselves under that law when we made a covenant with God with the Declaration of Independence, and we called upon him, and he has blessed us with his liberties. So hopefully that answers your question.
Can you hear me?
I can now.
Yeah, I'm trying to get my new mic in. It's not working out.
But I'll tell you what, it's louder now. It's a good level.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. But before I lose it, look, I only got a comment. If you think anarchy's bad, communism is worse. Anarchy, at least every man is for himself.
Communism, I agree on that. Right?
Communism says, no, the state is the God, and you will go by our rules, and you will worship the ruler, and blah, blah, blah. Anarchy.
Well, that in that state of being, that's a good place where anarchy is good.
That's right.
It's called rebellion.
There's more freedom in anarchy than there is in communism. And you know, communism, they put you to death for believing in God. So that's a worse situation than the anarchists. At least anarchists, they respect you if you have a gun like they do. You know, mm-hmm. where in communism, you're not allowed to have a gun. Only the leader can have the gun. Anyway, that's the point I was going to make. I don't understand how in this nation they can let a communist party run on a ticket, or even the workers' party, which is basically
that's against the law. That should be unlawful. But you see,
It always used to be, John.
But whether they do anything with it or not, only when the people take control and we have government by consent can we the people deal with that, because we the people could take it to task. And we can indict anyone. You see, if you are representing a communist position while you are holding an elected office or an appointed position in office, after you've raised your hand to support and defend the Constitution, you can believe anything you want, but you can't say and do anything you want. You have to then honor your oath, and you cannot lift up communism. You have to lift up the republic that we are, the constitutional republic.
And if you're a true communist, you can't take an oath to the Constitution. The two don't fit.
Again, look at you. Not talking about that. If a person just is social, they believe in socialism, they believe in communism, they just think that way. But if they're willing, look, if an atheist doesn't believe in God, he's really kind of, you know, rejects the common law to some degree, because he rejects to some degree natural rights. But in any event, an atheist can become an elected individual, but he took an oath, or she took an oath. Once they take the oath, they have to honor that oath. It doesn't matter what they believe. They have to lift up what the oath that they've held, which is the Constitution. That's the law. That's who we're under. If they can't do that, they shouldn't be running for office. So if anybody wants to run for office and they don't know the Constitution, and especially if they hold up the socialist view, I don't know how they get away with it. You look at what's that guy's name that's running for president?
Bernie Sanders?
Bernie Sanders. I mean, he's a socialist.
Yeah.
I mean, how could that be? All their positions are so far off the scale. You know, there is no right or left. It is just total law, socialism, communism, Nazism. It's all mixed into one bag.
We don't even need to discuss this anymore, because we have the Democrat Party now that proves that they're completely lawless. They call themselves Democrats. So, right. You know, they're the worst of the worst, the party. I mean, they might as well say they're the Soviet, you know, the Union of Communists and Socialists and whatever else.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'd like to make a note here. We are looking for Democrats as much as Republicans, and we've got quite a few Democrats that have signed up to become committeemen. We're going to post very soon a paper that we did here in New York as the elected committeemen. We rewrote the rules, and we're going to post that up, and people should look at those rules, and they should, every state should really bring those rules, get rid of whatever party rules are there, because it's nothing but garbage. You could start with that and work it away however you want. But, I mean, basically it's set up to liberate the people, ultimately, to prevent, and when you read through it, you'll see it's written in such a way to prevent someone from commandeering the control of the committeemen. And, just like these clowns up here in the Democratic Party and the judicial a committee. I don't know how they get away with not being removed from power. They're so powerful. What is this? I mean, who gave them such power? They have no more right and no more vote than any other of those individuals, those congressmen in that particular committee and or in the entire House. Everybody has one vote, and just because you have the hammer of the committee doesn't give you the power and the authority to just rule like a tyrant. I mean, remove that person. Get them out of there. Well, we make it very easy to get rid of the chairman. And a chairman shouldn't hold a position any longer than maybe a year. They should pass the gavel on to someone else, so to speak. But all they are is a traffic cop keeping order in the committee, moving things along, and making sure everyone is heard. I mean, these guys that run these committees, they suppress things from coming up onto the floor. That should never be. Where do they get this stuff from? And that's what we got to change. That's what we got to stop. We got, it starts in the committee, man. We get rid of it in the committee, man. We've written rules. We voted on it. It's the rules of New York. And when we get elected in there again, we're going to take those rules and apply them. And we will offer them to all the other states. They come together and bring to order a good set of rules. They can make some changes here or there, fudge it around, maybe make it better. But definitely make sure that we keep the rules written in such a fashion that one individual can't take control of the others. That's the problem. But with that, we should be moving on to our callers here because it's getting late here. And how many callers we have left?
We got like four or five.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. You got the controls back.
I'm going to go to the next one, which is Barbara from New
York. Are you whispering? Because I can barely hear you right now.
Really? I thought it was good.
It was good. What happened?
I don't know. Strange thing.
Ah. So,
anyway, I'm going to open Barbara up. And if you can't hear me, you're going to have to. I got to get this new mic installed.
Hi.
Hi. How are you doing? Miss Barbara?
Hi. Yes, Barbara from New York. I wanted to comment and just ask, and then after I comment, ask your, your take on the whole thing with the, in New York State, the bail reform that's coming in January. And, I'm trying to figure out, I've been reading a little bit about it, trying to figure out what the whole purpose of it is. I see that they say, they've had it in California and it hasn't been a very good thing. And they say at least in January, if somebody breaks into your house, all they do is they let them go. Burglary and theft is they're not going to keep the people. And so you're going to have, they say they're going to like triple or quadruple the number of releases that they, supervised releases they have. Now they have some supervised releases, but it's all nonviolent crime now, and this will include violent. And I was looking at, what are they doing? How can you justify this? And the first part of this article, I'm reading this article from, it's called The Gothamist, it says that it's been unfair because those who don't have money have to wait in jail, and those that do have money can get off on bail, which is kind of crazy. I mean, it should just be looked at in terms of the risk to the community at large, as far as I can tell. I mean, but then you look at, well, okay, so how are they going to do it? Well, they have, it looks to me like they're using this as like a experiment to try out these things. And so they've got, of course, it involves a bunch of NGO-type organizations that are going to help them with this supervised release. And so they've got... they have something called a risk assessment tool, so they're gonna track these released people with a data analytic team that they call. So they have a partner named Luminosity Data Analytics. Such a technocracy thing, constantly keeping track of the population, keeping track of all our information, what we do. It's like, and then I'm wondering whether it's like testing the whole mechanism of pre-crime. They say that they have another group called Crime Lab New York and then another group called Ideas 42 that has a global reach, and they study these supervised release people, and they, decide what kind of interventions work and what don't. So there's more information gathered on the people, more surveillance. And then there's another group also involved in this whole supervised release system called Criminal Justice Agency, and they say it's a nonprofit pretrial services agency combining operations, demonstrations, projects and research all under one roof. And what they've already been they've already using them. And what they do is they interview the release, supervised release people, and then they say they've already do like 200,000 interviews a year, and then after they interview, they talk to the judge, and then they decide who's a good candidate for release and who isn't. And it seems to me like you're getting NGOs involved in the judicial process, and they, you know, I don't know that we want that, you know, making decisions like that. So anyway, what do you? Also, I'm just really. They say that prosecutors and judges are thinking that this is really not. They're responding apparently, from what I've heard, saying this is not going to be real safe. So, can you tell me what you think? What? Why would they do this? And also, how can our, you know, New York senators and representatives say that they're concerned about our safety? You know, we have to monitor you. We got to confiscate your guns and limit your guns. And then they're releasing people who have, you know, broken into homes, and they don't even, you know, they don't even hold them. I mean, how can they possibly say that they care about our safety?
Well,
and also, what do you think is the whole end game here?
Are you still hearing me at all?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. All right. So here's the first thing. Look at bail needs reform, and especially in New York, they abuse it. And it's absolutely true that those that have money get out, and those that don't sit in jail and rot and wait for their day in court. Now,
okay.
The key is they said they're letting nonviolent people go. And I mean, if it's truly
right.
Nonviolent, what difference does it make? Because if they don't show up for their court day, guess what happens? The cops come, they arrest them, and they throw them in jail. Now, they don't get bail. They're in jail. So who cares? Because they're not taking care of restitution to the injured party. They never do. The state's the one that's making money on this. But the trouble is, if the state is doing bail reform and they're releasing people and they're bringing all these NGOs in to monitor them, I don't trust a thing they're doing. You're right. They're just looking for another way for pre-crime to monitor all of us. Look, we're all going to be released prisoners at some point or another. They're going to make us all in the prison planet, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
So I don't trust them, and I don't think anything they're doing is good. However, if they're letting people out for nonviolent crimes, I think that's a good thing. Because look, you got to show up for your hearing. Okay, so you broke in a house. That could be dangerous, but they didn't catch you with a gun. You didn't hold anybody at knife point. Maybe they were away for the week or whatever. That's not necessarily a dangerous guy. That's a guy that's looking for some money or a meal or you know, maybe he is a drug addict. I don't know. But, you know, having these jails full of these people doesn't make us any safer. I don't believe that.
No.
You want to be safe, put a shotgun in your closet and arm yourself, and then you're safe. Because that guy could be breaking, you call the cops, and they'll get there, you know, when seconds count, cops get there in minutes. That's a fact of life. So
if
you
it's
know,
nonviolent, I have no problem with it.
They're not letting anybody go but nonviolent. Of course, you know, there's abuses everywhere. But right now, the whole system stinks. It's absolutely the criminal justice system. They named it properly, you know, because it is criminal. Mm. And I don't know what they're doing, and I don't know that much about this release. A lot of people are against it, but who's against it? Judges and prosecutors. Well, guess what? Most of the judges and prosecutors I know need to be in jail.
Yeah, right.
So if they're against it, there's a reason they're against it. They're not making money. But apparently there's another group out there of probably judges and lawyers and maybe even prosecutors that have figured out a new way to make money and to extend this system. You know, they got things where they get you on DWI and they put you through these classes, and if the teacher doesn't think you learned your lesson, he recycles you back through. Well, how he determines whether you learned your lesson or not is he looks at the new people coming in. If he doesn't have enough people for the next class, he says, you got to go again. And so now you got to pay that $2,000 or whatever it is. You got to pay it again. It's a money-making scam is all it is.
Well, so, think about, I mean, we're taxpayers are going to pay for this whole big set of NGOs. I mean,
yeah, I absolutely. Who gets? Who always pays? We the people pay. I don't like holding people in jail, especially for months and months waiting for a trial. That's baloney. You know what I mean? And if you're letting nonviolent people go, good, God bless them. I'm all for it.
That's what they're doing now, they say.
Yeah,
nonviolent,
but, you know,
now. But I've heard that it goes beyond the theft.
Well, listen,
first of all, I think
I'm going to tell you something. Every day you commit five or six felonies, you don't even know it. So when they start cracking down on this stuff, guess what? We're all nonviolent offenders, aren't we? They'll be holding us in our houses, and they'll be surveilling us, and they'll be questioning us, and they'll be doing their pre-crime thing, and then they'll find out you bought a box of shells. They say, oh, you must be going to go shoot the judge. You know, next thing you will be in jail, you know? I don't trust anything they're doing. I don't believe that they're doing anything for the people. You know, you got to follow the money in these things. Who's the corporation pushing this? Who are the people behind it? And these non-government organizations, they're like, if there's going to be any kind of misuse and fraud, it's always through these NGOs. Look at what was Blackwater and all these other things, Halliburton, all that stuff. Those were all NGOs run by government officials. You know what I mean? That was Dick Cheney making billions of dollars on false wars and false weapons of destruction. And our servicemen had to have their laundry cleaned by a government contractor, and it cost them like $75 to $100 to get done. Meanwhile, they could go down the street to some little Pakistani that was starving, and they could give him the laundry and they could get it done for $2. And if they did that, they would get court-martialed. It was all a scam. It's all to put money on the table for all these military and government officials that are stuffing their pockets full. The Clinton Foundation, all of them stuffing their pockets full on the military-industrial complex that which we were warned against. Anyway, I want to move ahead. We only got a few minutes, and that was a very good point you made. I'm glad you brought it up because it's something that it's another thing that we got to watch out for. I don't know what they're cooking, but I don't trust them at all. It stinks.
I just think having someone break into your house could lead to violence so quickly. I just don't.
Absolutely, but let me tell you what, that can happen anytime, and really your first thing is to protect yourself. Because, if they could put those people in jail, there's another one behind them ready to break in. If everybody armed themselves, we wouldn't have this problem. Look at it.
Same time they take away the guns. I mean, say they're working
well, see,
so hard.
Well, see, that's the problem, right? So what do we have? Yeah. We have a prison planet. We're all nonviolent offenders, and they're going to watch us in our own homes, and that's what this is leading to. That's what I say.
Yeah.
Anyway,
thank you.
I'm going to go ahead.
Thanks
thank
a
you,
lot.
Barbara. Appreciate it. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg.
Okay, we got Odum's Marvin. Marvin? Odum's? Odum Marvin? I don't know. I'm going to unmute you. Let me know what state you're in there.
Yes, hello. This is Marvin from Brooklyn.
Oh, from Brooklyn. How's it going in Brooklyn today?
Oh, it's not too bad. It's about 40 degrees here.
Yeah.
It's. I have a question concerning the jurisdictional challenge on a mortgage, you know. I'm trying to figure out who do I address this challenge you? Is it to the bank, or is it to the district attorney, or, you know, who do I address it, mail it to?
Well, when we challenge jurisdiction, I mean, it's because they're not giving you the due process. They're not giving you your day in court. They're foreclosing, you know, without giving you due process or jurisdiction. So our paperwork actually shows where it goes, and most of the time we're referring it up to the federal court for cause. We move it to the federal court for cause.
Okay, but you started, it seems like you're starting it in the court that you were in, the state court, but then you want to move it. I mean, they have to be, you give it to them to respond first before you move it into federal court.
No, here's what happens. When they violate your inalienable rights, it automatically isn't, you can't, the state has no jurisdiction over that anymore. The state can't rule on what the state is doing. It needs to go to the federal court, whether they like it or not. That's why they don't have jurisdiction over it. I mean, the higher state court can come in and correct the lower court, but that never happens. It just never happens. And you can sue a court collaterally. You can sue that court from the federal court, and you don't need, you know. A lot of times they'll come back and say, well, you haven't exhausted, all of your
your remedies in the lower court. Well, you don't need to exhaust your remedies if they violated one of your unalienable rights. The second they do that, they're in violation of the Constitution, and we don't need to talk about anything else. As a matter of fact, that's, you know, you go in there, you don't put all the minutiae of the case in. What you put in there is the violation of due process to your unalienable rights, and that's all you talk about. You don't talk about how much money you owe. You don't talk about anything else. Don't talk about whether the mortgage was yours or it wasn't yours. None of that, you know, it's real money, it's fiat money, it's, all that stuff doesn't mean anything, because that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is that lower court and those officials down there and the bank and whoever else did it and whoever entered into it, because they all got their fingers in the pie looking to get money. Basically,
yes.
they violate your due process rights. They move in rem on you all the time, which means that you don't get a day in court. And they go, oh, it's not against you, it's against the property, or whatever they're doing. So, you know, we're challenging jurisdiction based on the fact that the state and the lower courts have moved against your unalienable rights, and so then it needs to be in federal court. And the state court really doesn't have jurisdiction to rule on it. Listen, you can appeal to the state court. The higher court can correct the lower court. You know, anytime they want to move to the right side, the law is not going to prevent them from doing that. So if a state Supreme Court judge looks down at the county court judge or whatever, or a district court judge looks down, he can correct those lower courts anytime he wants. As a matter of fact, one of the problems with them is they should be correcting the lower courts, and they're not. So they're part and parcel, part of the problem, because they're not doing their jobs. But you don't need to beg the state court for remedy. When they violated your unalienable rights, you can go right to the federal court. And there is, you know, look, there is a little tug of war between the federal and the state, because they're jealous of each other's powers. And so I think it's the best place to be, because they want to make a point. And, you know, a lot of times you'll be able to get it fixed in the federal court against the state court, because they want to show that they're the big cheeses, and it gives them an opportunity to do that. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, I, you know, other than that, I don't know what else I can tell you. I don't know if I.
No, what you're saying is correct. I'm up against a sale or auction sale or what have you in the state court. I mean, and like you said, they violated all my due process rights. You can't even get a constitutional decision. They write these short form orders that have no law, no facts, no evidence, and it's just the arbitrary and capricious, you know, opinions of the judge. And I'm like, well, I mean, what is this? I mean, you're taking someone's house and you don't even put the law in or facts in your order. I mean, it's not even.
Let me ask you something. What happens when they auction your house off? And they get more money than what the amount of the loan was. What happens to the proceeds to that? Do you get it back?
Absolutely. The investors take the proceeds.
You're not supposed
whoever,
to.
Whoever that's, the house, the investor
that's
takes
unlawful.
That.
That's unlawful. Oh, what is this?
That's exactly why the investor stops and steps in and purchases the house, because the house is worth more than what the loan is. And you have a
well,
problem.
I know in New York State, one of the things that they do is they, especially with tax sales, they convert the deed before they have the sale. So they make the house that, like, the county owns it or the state owns it. And so then when they go ahead and sell it at a tax sale, what the county does, or the state does, I should say, is they come in with the sheriff and they evict you as a scofflaw tenant on your own property, because they're saying we own it. So that's they it's called conversion, and it's another illegal in rem process where they put their name on the deed. They can't put their name on your deed without you having a day in court, without them telling you the law that they're operating under, and without hearing your side of the story. And they do it every day. They do it hundreds of them a day. So
yeah, they do.
You know, at least if you're filling out the paperwork, and we can help you with that if you want. You know, you fill out one of the intake forms. At least you're complaining and you're identifying the problem. You know, you know, we can't guarantee you results, but it's certainly the language you want to use, and it's the place you want to go. You know, and it helps if you know the law and you can articulate yourself, because other than that, you know, they look, if they know that we're helping people fill paperwork out, so a lot of times they call our bluff, because if you can't get into court and you can't defend your position, they will steamroll
right.
over you. They don't respect you. So, but if you go in there and you talk well and you put the law down, then the judge might be a little afraid, especially if you're going into the federal court with it. And look, at if they get way out of hand, you can actually hold them personally liable for that. And you can sue you can sue the officials, which really gets them on edge if you do that. And then they got to recuse themselves from the case. So, that's, you know, I mean, that's another place that we haven't gone, but certainly you can go there.
Right. Right.
So I hope that makes things clear for not only for you but other people listening to this. There's, you know, there's lots of questions out there, and so. You know,
so I should just start with the constitutional challenge in federal court. I should move it
to federal court for cause, and we have paperwork on that that you can look at. You can copy that. We have forms for how to move it. And in that particular paperwork that we've written, it's an education, because the footnotes teach you by what authority we do that and by why they don't have jurisdiction. So when you read that paper, you'll get an education. Now, if the judges and the attorneys and that would read the paperwork, they would get an education, but they don't want to read anything. They just want to do what they do and make their money.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I hope that answered your question.
Yes,
you
did.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right.
Okay, we got, looks like tomorrow in Florida. I'm losing my voice. Go ahead. You are unmuted, Florida. Hello, Florida. Can you hear me? This is Mission Control. Are you there? Can you hear me tomorrow from Florida?
Yes.
There you go. I thought we put you to sleep. No.
Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Let's see. I had a ton of questions, but I got tired in the midst of all of it.
Well, just give me one, because we only got about 5 minutes, and you're the second to the last in loss.
Okay. Well, let's see.
Pick one.
Okay. I have a main question. I filed my case to go to federal court, and there's been no response. However, my son is caught up in this, and no one cares for him but father and me. No one cares.
You filed your case in federal court?
I did.
How many days ago? How long ago?
40 days, I think.
Well, I believe we give them 60 days, the federal court, only because that's customary in common law or something like that.
Yes.
But what you need to do is you need to pay attention. And when they go one day over that filing, then you need to file a default. They lose by
default.
That's right, because in law, silence means they agree. And
right.
That's a good thing if they do that, because look, at sometimes they want to lose by default because they want to save face, and that allows you to go in there, file the default, and if somebody's being held, they have to release them. They've lost the case. They didn't answer in a timely manner. So you should be praying for a default, because it's something that's the best thing that can happen to you. So just because they didn't, look, they typically wait till the last day anyway, because that's the game they play. And plus, they're looking at the paperwork and they're not sure what to do, and the phones are ringing off the hook here and there, and they got to get them to the right. Oh, this is one of them sovereign papers or whatever they're trying to call it. But they're getting more and more of this stuff. So hopefully they won't answer you. And I don't know if you file that through us. Did you use us for help? So what's going to happen is you'll get to help with the default, and that's a good thing. So the minute that it's over, you make sure that you get a hold of Jim or whoever you're working with.
Yeah.
And let them know that, you know, it's time to file for a default. And then we'll help you do that.
Okay, I'm taking another case here this week and starting the process.
Okay. Well, hopefully, maybe you'll prevail on a default.
Yes.
Really easy
Father will prevail. I do know that. And I would just like to also say thank you, because as I've joined the NLA, I've just learned so much, and I'm currently registered as a grand jury administrator, taking all of the courses, and I also want to register as a committeeman, because I feel that's really an important part of why I want to do this, so that I can help others as solid in our foundation.
And we need to resurrect that system that's all screwed up. The committeeman system is all messed up. We need to fix it.
Yep.
And the only one that's going to fix it is the people. I think one of the reasons it got so screwed up is because we got lazy and people lost interest. And like you end up with a county chairman, the party chairman, that's in there for 30 years because nobody else wants the position, nobody wanted to do it, and it's a shame because it doesn't take that much time. And look, you can't tell me that we don't have retired people that got nothing better to do that could be county chairs and they could switch it off. I mean, I know there's an awful lot of retired people in this county, and many of them are very intelligent people. It doesn't, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to do this stuff. It just, you just have to understand the actual power that you have. And I'll just give you a quote. I think it was Jefferson. He said, "Those who refuse to get involved in politics are destined to be ruled by their inferiors who do."
Yeah, I think that's been a problem in this country, because personally, I, as a follower of Christ, didn't want to get involved in politics. I didn't think it was my place. I felt that I should keep things separated, as I've been raised to believe. And
they tried it. They tried to separate church and state, and that's a mistake.
Yes.
Because God was always in the state, always, involved. And actually, the committee man system came from the Mosaic system with Moses and Aaron, and it was tens of families and hundreds of families, and nothing got to Moses and Aaron unless they couldn't flush it out in the committees,
Right.
So the first place that things get worked out is the family. And the family could be tens of people or hundreds of people. Big families are hundreds of people. So the proper thing was, when there's a problem, you flush it out in the family. And then if you can't get the family and can't figure it out, then you go into the community. And usually if it's a big enough issue, it's affecting other people outside in other families. It becomes, it becomes a social issue. And then, it moves through that process. And then if it's big enough, eventually it got to Moses and Aaron. So that was what the system, the committee man system, was kind of done, designed off of that biblical system.
Mm-hmm.
Which God expects you to be active in your community. He tells you to correct your brother and all this other stuff, and that's part of the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that we're supposed to stick our heads in the sand and not notice anything and not get involved, because technically you're helping when you get involved. Look at police officers. It used to be to protect and serve, and now what are they doing? They're nothing more than statutory regulation fine collectors. That's all they are.
Yes.
They're not looking to protect and serve. They're looking for probable cause to pull you over to get a bigger fine they'll find something that they can make big dollars on. And I do in state inspections, and I have to have a tint meter, and the tint meter says right on it, it says your probable cause tool right in your hand, and that's all it's about. They don't give a crap about your tinted windows. It's just a matter of pulling you over and smelling alcohol or drugs or some other such stuff that they can and if it's really bad, they'll plant stuff on you. Look, if they don't have that V&T law to pull you over in the first place, if they do that wrong, then whatever they find after that is fruit of the poison tree. They have to throw it out.
Yeah, I know that I'm involved in that, because I was walked upon by a police officer and told, "I'm gonna arrest you." And from that point forward, everything that was done was wrong.
Yeah, Yeah, and that's a lot of that, you know. And you say, what do you arrest her for? Well, we arrest her for resisting arrest. Well, no, wait a minute. Yeah. What were you arresting her for in the first place? You know what I mean?
Right.
You know,
and, you know, I
like,
find...
Well, you know, we asked some questions. Why'd you ask a question? What was your... What crime was this person suspected of in the first place that you would even ask them to identify themselves? Because technically,
right.
you don't need to identify yourself...
At
if
all.
if you're not suspected of a crime.
That's correct.
You know?
Yeah, I found it quite funny because my daughter, she's an accountant. She works for Hyatt Regency and she lives in upstate or in New York. And she said to me, Mom, what were you arrested for? And I said, resisting arrest. And she said, you know, I didn't believe them when they told me that, but now that you're repeating it, I believe you. She says, you can't be arrested for resisting arrest. I was like, duh, now you're understanding.
Yeah, but, you know, when they get to court, they'll say, well, you know, she had a light out, or she fit the description, or we smelled
right.
something. You know, they always got a probable cause excuse. And
right.
unless you can get that cop on the stand with a real good litigator, or you're a good litigator, and break him and make him nervous, they're going to uphold the probable cause scenario. You know?
You know, that brings me to another question, because I called the court of record, and I spoke to them with regards to my documents. They told me there is no case on record.
Yeah. I don't know what that's all about, but okay.
That, to me, that tells me that the family courts that are involved with me did not record anything except in their own court.
Well, yeah, because the family court, they're holding outside of the regular court. And they're making their own rules from the bench all the time.
Yep.
And one of the things we found that we have experienced with in the family court is you move it out of the family court, you move it into the regular court, because ultimately they're going to do something that violates your rights. And even if it's a person in there that you can sue in the regular court, if you move it to the Supreme Court out of the family court, they don't get away with that baloney and they don't like it.
Right.
And sometimes
right.
that will win you the case because they don't have the stomach for it. Because they're so
yeah,
used to
and I
so
also noticed that the policeman that arrested me, he no longer is on the force.
Yeah, so he probably was a troublemaker. They had to get rid of him. Maybe.
Oh, I'm sure he was, the way he told me he was going to womanize me and beat me up, basically.
Boy, too bad you didn't have that on a recording.
Well, if they recorded it at all, it's on a recording, because the man stood
yeah,
outside the station and told me he was going to have fun putting me down, basically. The way he said it, I just couldn't believe it.
You got to have your recorder with your cell phone or something. They, you know, you can't, they get away with that stuff, but, you know, unless
oh,
you
yeah. Oh, yeah, they took me to court in the middle of the night. It was almost 11 o'clock at night, and they took me in front of a judge that... one was a magistrate, and two that had been involved with my husband and his wife of 6 months before I was divorced from him by marrying him and working with him.
Yeah, see, that's a conflict. That's something that
oh, yes. I'm really going to be glad that
there, yeah.
go down.
Yeah.
They have kept me down for 8 years and done things that are just inappropriate through divorce court. So
yeah, well,
it's high
really,
time they all answer for their
yeah,
own
well, family court and divorce court, I don't think it's any worse than those two. But anyway, we're 7 past the hour, so unless you have...
Thank you.
I appreciate it, and thank you very
appreciate
much.
Appreciate you. And I'm Tamara, and I'm in Florida.
Okay, Tamara. Good talking to you. Thank you,
thank
everybody.
You. Nice to see you.
Yeah. Thank you, Brent, and everybody else, and Jan, and John, and everybody. I'm sure I forgot 100 of the people that make this possible. We'll see
yeah.
you next Monday, same time,
yep.
same station. Thank you.
Thank you.